blocking side effects linked to medications for movement disorders, which affect the activity of dopamine.
I was gambling on all sorts of things, and I lost 25 grand in a night.
If these dangers were known about for decades, why were so many patients and families left in the dark? Impulsive starts tomorrow afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 15th of February. This is Tina Ritchie. Good morning. Iran's deputy foreign minister has told the BBC that the ball is now in America's court to prove it's ready to negotiate a deal over Tehran's nuclear programme. Speaking to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet, in the Iranian capital, Majid Takhravanchi said his country could consider compromising if the US allowed discussions about a lifting of sanctions. A second round of talks this month will be held on Tuesday in Geneva. Lise Doucet is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
Mr. Takhravanchi said they were receiving messages in public and private that the US was interested in reaching a deal. But he expressed concern about President Trump's conflicting signals. In his latest comments, the U.S. leader said regime change would be the best thing to happen in Iran. Takhravanchi, who's playing a key role in this process, said that wasn't the message they were receiving in private. Takhravanchi said they were ready to discuss compromises in their nuclear program to reach an agreement if the U.S. was prepared to lift sanctions now crippling Iran's economy.
The ball is in America's court. I mean, they have to prove that they want to have a deal with us. And if there is a sincerity, if we see a sincerity on their part, I'm sure that we will be on a road to have an agreement.
He expressed hope a deal was in reach, but said Iran had also taken every step to defend itself if it came to war.
A Labour group which helped Keir Starmer win the party leadership paid for a report which investigated the personal and religious background of a Sunday Times journalist. Labour Together commissioned a US lobbying firm to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of a story about the think tank's donations. The resulting report included details about the journalist's faith and upbringing. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
It was late 2023 when Gabriel Pogrant was one journalist behind a Sunday Times report on undeclared donations at Labour Together. At the time, the group was led by Josh Simons, now a minister in the Cabinet Office. He commissioned the US public affairs firm, APCO Worldwide, to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of the story. He has since said he feared a suspected illegal hack which had nothing to do with UK journalists. But the report that APCO delivered included claims about Mr. Pogrant's Jewish faith, his relationships and upbringing. Mr. Simons said the company had strayed beyond its brief. APCO did not respond to requests for comment.
The paediatrician who led a major review of NHS child gender services in England has told the BBC that some young people questioning their gender have been misled by what they've seen on social media. Dr. Hilary Cass, who produced her report in 2024, told Sunday with Laura Kunzberg that children have been influenced by unrealistic images and expectations, and they may not have pursued medical treatments if they'd taken more time before making the decision. Dr. Cass said it was vital that people understood what medical transition involves.
For those young people who are going to grow up and never be comfortable in their body, a medical transition is the only way they're going to be able to live their life successfully and comfortably. But if that's not the path that you were intended to be on, it's a huge cost to go through quite intensive medical treatments and sometimes quite brutal surgeries, when actually if you'd taken more time, that might not have been your pathway.
The UK Health Security Agency says several children have been treated in hospital after what officials are calling a big measles outbreak in North London. About a third of the 95 cases confirmed so far this year in England have been in the London borough of Enfield. The agency is urging anyone whose child hasn't had both doses of the MMR vaccine to act quickly. Analysis from the union body, the TUC, suggests the gap between men's and women's pay in England and Wales won't close for another 30 years at the current rate of change. The research says that although the gender pay gap has shrunk slightly every year since the pandemic, on average, a woman's full-time annual salary is £2,500 lower than a man's. The head of equalities at the TUC, Vic Jones, explained what they'd like to see.
We're calling on businesses to adopt and to publish really detailed, robust action plans that explain how they're going to address their gender pay gap. That might be looking at their policies around flexible working, around career progression, because we know we need to see progress from employers in this area.
BBC News.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What? Be
my home. Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. On Your Farm is in Shetland in half an hour at Garth's Croft on the island of Bressay, where the crofter has a passion for heritage and native breeds, trees and archaeology. Before that, here's Laurie Taylor with Thinking Aloud.
Nearly 60 years ago, when I was a junior sociology lecturer at the University of York, I was invited, together with Stanley Cohen, to give a series of lectures to the inmates of the maximum security wing of Durham Prison. Well, at that time, this small wing housed some of the country's most feared, most notorious criminals. John McVicar, the Cray brothers, Ian Brady, and the great train robber Bruce Reynolds. Well, we wrote a book about our time in Durham Prison, a book called Psychological Survival, which attempted, among other things, to document the distinctive claustrophobia of the security wing, the lifeless, the almost soundless atmosphere. It's like living in a submarine, said one prisoner. All of which meant that I was fascinated to read a new book which concentrated on the soundscape of a very different prison, a far more, normal type of prison, a soundscape composed of constant clangs, bangs and jangles, a veritable cacophony of sound. And that book is entitled Sound, Order and Survival in Prison, The Rhythms and Routines of HMS Midtown. And its author is Kate Herity, formerly the Mellon King's Research Fellow in Punishment at King's College, University of Cambridge. She now joins me. Tell me, Kate, how did you first become interested in this, what we could call the sensory life of prisons and sound in particular?
It was the very first time I visited a prison while I was still a library assistant before I returned to education as a mature student. I was there visiting a library, the library of HMP Wandsworth, and while I stood on the central control point, I was absolutely overwhelmed by the sound and movement all around me coming off the spurs, and I thought that must have some significance for the people who live and work there.
Well, tell me a little bit about your field work then at this place you call the Midtown Prison. I mean, how long were you there? What did you do?
I was there for over a year. I sometimes participated in various programmes the prison was running, but mostly I hung around on the wing, talking to people, listening, gaining a familiarity with the soundscape.
And you were listening. I mean, listening. What did listening help you to understand that other approaches to understanding prisons might miss? I mean, what was added, if you like, to our knowledge about prisons through your listening?
A multitude of things, actually, from the broader to the more personal. So in terms of the composition of order and stability that you experience on a good day, to the means by which sound provided a point of assessing when things were going wrong, violence and the eruption of violence has its own soundscape and interruption to the normal sound, how power works, how the soundscape adds a dimension of prison experience beyond the relational between prisoners and staff, but also, of course, the way different members of that community experience the soundscape, particularly those who have neurodivergence or mental health issues.
I mean, when I was reading it, I got this real sense of the overwhelming noise of the place. I mean, in practical terms, what does that constant noise mean for the people who are trying to live and just trying to sleep there?
For some people who are institutionalised, particularly, I think, it is a part of normality. So my very first research project was as an undergraduate, and I spoke to people about the meaning of music. And one person told me that while they were incarcerated in young offenders institutions, they often shared cells with people who'd been in care, and they needed the radio on or a source of noise through the night to feel comfortable, to feel safe. People adapt to the massive soundscape by raising their voice and get into a habit of shouting, which of course can be interpreted as hostile and aggressive, but is in fact just a means of making yourself heard and understood. And of course, if you have particular challenges, whether that be mental health, neurodisability or neurodivergence, trying to cope with the constant sensory overwhelm can be a huge stressor and something that impacts on how people cope and how people resettle after their sentence.
You talk about something like prison sonar, you know, that as it were, everything is communicated, has to be shouted around. I mean, I've just come from an office, almost total silence prevails now. It didn't used to in the old days, now it does totally. But in prison, you have to communicate by shouting, you suggest.
Yeah, frequently, because you only have a very short... I mean, it depends on your status and so forth, but often, particularly in a local prison where the opportunities for meaningful activity are so few and limited, you may only have a very short amount of time to get all your daily business, your phone calls, get your meds, negotiate for whatever it is you need. You've only got a very short time to do that. So if you also want to speak to a friend or a colleague, you haven't got the time to be running downstairs waiting to be unlocked in order to do that. So you'll shout.
I mean, your research professionalism meant that you actually stayed in the prison overnight. I mean, I can only guess what that was like. I mean, one knows how difficult it is to sleep, even with quite slight disturbances which can awake you. But in prison overnight, the sounds?
I wasn't trying to sleep. I was trying to stay awake, actually, and to get a sense of what those spaces turn into overnight. Aside from the mice and roaches, which made it actually really hard to find anywhere comfortable to settle because you didn't want to sit anywhere in case you got visited by scuttling friends. There were several people who were profoundly distressed, which was causing disruption for other people. And of course, Midtown is comprised of one main wing. That happens routinely. And people can go without sleep for a very long time before the person who's having a mental health crisis or a problem is moved. But also how relatively quiet it was quite striking to me. When the lights go down, everybody kind of observes, or most people observe, a kind of normative, this is sleep time now. But I was really unused to being in those spaces for such long periods without the men to talk to, and I felt profoundly lonely. And I did fall asleep at one point, quite surprisingly.
I've got a clip here. These are the words we voiced up of one of the prisoners you call Stretch. And it sort of conveys this idea of how sounds can really mean so much. It's about the atmosphere at any particular time.
You can always tell how a prison's going to be when you come in the morning. If you can hear, say you come in this prison at 7:15 in the morning, it's nice and quiet, you know everybody's calm and settled. But you know if you come in the morning and you can hear music playing early and banter, you know there's trouble in the place. Seriously.
Kate, tell me a little bit more about this phrase, reading the soundscape. I think that's your phrase. What do you mean by it?
I mean reaching a point beyond attuning to it, which is when you've reached a point of familiarity that you know when something's out of step, when something isn't right, not the everyday tune that's normal for here, which every social space has. But when you become sufficiently attuned to make sense of it, to interpret it, to decipher what's going on. So you reach a point, and it's one you reach unconsciously, actually, where all of a sudden you know the distinction between some banter and an exchange which is heightening tension and may or may not erupt.
Sticking with the sounds and what these sounds can mean to people in prison, I mean, you describe how some prisoners felt that certain sounds really, they triggered important memories for them. Tell me about that.
Well, often those were either sounds that they brought with them or that they evoked separate from the actual soundscape.
Sounds they brought with them, what do you mean?
So memories of, for example, dogs barking or planes taking off, particular music. And of course, that's something that more of us are immediately familiar with. There are songs that we associate with love, loss, good times. And those sounds work to elicit feelings of longing and loneliness, as well as reminding people of their broader identity outside of the prison.
That soundscape, you've been describing it very well. I mean, do you think there's a better recognition of the sound that goes on in prisons could help to improve conditions for prisoners and staff? I think somewhere you refer to putting down some carpets as a way of muffling a bit of the noise. But it's as though, is the noise simply taken for granted? Is it accepted by prisoners and by staff? That's the way it is?
Broadly, yes. And I think as we start to have those conversations in a more meaningful way, we have the capacity to really think about the prisons we're building and what we're building them for, what we're building them to do. There are vast numbers of people in our prisons who are entering them with an array of challenges and vulnerabilities that are exacerbated and made harder to cope with by the sensory overload that they're subjected to night and day. And that extends to staff as well, who also are more likely to have post-traumatic stress, brain injury, because they're veterans, because they've experienced violent incidents. And actually, all of these things have very real implications for human rights law and the way we safeguard people's dignity and ensure that these are survivable environments. So I think there's a lot of work to do, and we are only just beginning to have those conversations.
Do you still hear some of those sounds of prison in your head?
Always, yes.
Always?
Yeah, I'm also neurodivergent myself, so I'm particularly sensitive to the soundscape. There was a bell that went off at various points that I would jump every time. I still dream of the prison, not just that prison, but other prisons I've spent time in. The sensory after images stay with you. And then they stay with me. They stay with the people that I've spoken to, who are transported back to their time inside long after they have left the prison.
Kate Herity, thank you very much for the moment. There was one other environmental element almost completely absent in Durham's E-Wing, and that was colour. Colour, yes. Where were the colours? No colours. Because I was reminded of that missing element by the emails which were prompted by our recent discussion of colour in film. Particular thanks here to Chris Friday for his very erudite email, and thanks also to Deirdre, who picked me up on a quotation from George Harrison, which I cited in last week's programme. Liverpool, George said, is a place where people go out on a Monday night and don't worry about Tuesday. Deirdre, however, checked Google and found the quote attributed to Carl Jung, of all people. He never visited Liverpool in all his life, but he dreamt of the city and described it as a dark, sooty city on a dark, rainy night. Gosh. Our address for your comments on today's programme is thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Don't forget, you can find the long back catalogue of our programmes on BBC Sounds. Over the years, we've had discussions about life imprisonment, prison protest, TV and music in prisons, and architecture, hope and prison design, all there on BBC Sounds. But now I must turn to another ubiquitous feature of life inside prisons, the constant fear of violence and victimisation. And that is the subject of another fine piece of inside research by my next guest. She is Kate Gooch, Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Bath, and the author of Prison Violence, The Search for Recognition and Respect. And Kate's now with me. Well, I suppose I've got to, first of all, and this doesn't sound like the easiest thing to research at all, so you must tell me about how you set about it. What was your method?
Well, the book is set in a young offender institution for young men aged 18 to 21 years old. And the original aim was to consider why that particular young offender institution had failed the healthy prison test as inspected by an inspector of prisons, and to understand how to reduce high levels of violence within the prison. And one of the things that we were very aware of, myself and Professor James Treadwell, with whom I did the research, was that the quantitative studies really didn't tell us very much about why young men were violent in prison, or indeed what might be causing these quite stubbornly high levels of prison violence. And so what we did was we spent 9 months in the Young Offender Institution, really, like Kate was saying, making sense of the sounds, the smells, who was coming and going, the social dynamics, what was causing the violence, but also sensing the moral climate of the prison, the sort of shift in the prison as it changed and improved with good moral leadership. And we spent a lot of time hanging around. We were there first thing in the morning, last thing at night. We were given keys, which meant we could roam around the prison. And we also did a series of interviews with some of the young men, but also with some of the staff. And that allowed us to tease out not just their reflections and their narratives about their lives in prison or before, but also the things that we were seeing, whether that be incidents or noise and clothes on the floor or litter along the landings.
I mean, why did you choose young offenders, though?
There were two reasons, really. One was I just finished my doctoral research, which was on children in, particularly teenage boys in young offender institutions. I was more interested in the wider questions about why men, and particularly young men and children, engage in violence. And my colleague, James Treadwell, he was also interested in violence amongst men. So there was a wider interest there. But of course, at the time, we were seeing an increase in prison violence in this state. Since we started the research, that has only continued to rise. And so the problem of prison violence has always been present, but it continues to be, particularly at the moment.
I mean, here's the big fat question. I mean, what did you learn about the major causes of violence?
So I think when we think about prison violence, naturally our attention goes to the individuals concerned. I think what I very much learnt from this particular project was high levels of prison violence are less about individuals and more about the environment. So the reasons why we saw such an increase in prison violence in that particular young offender institution, but also elsewhere, is because of changes in the moral environment within the prison. So where we saw injustice, indignity, a lack of fairness, a lack of integrity, and young men in particular being treated with very little worth and seen as sort of undeserving of humane treatment, that created an environment where violence was more, not less, likely. We have the prisons we create. Over the last decade in particular, we've stripped so much resource from prisons that they've gone below a sort of, not just an economic threshold, but a moral threshold. We have too few staff, there's too little activity, and we hold people in conditions that are often very poor. And it is for these reasons that violence has often increased.
I mean, I remember from all those years ago, a long, long time ago, in Durham Prison, I remember having a very strong sense of hierarchy, you know, who was above who and who was below who. So, I mean, one of the key elements of your research involved looking at the social hierarchy among the prisoners and their relationships with one another. We voiced up a quote here. This is from a prisoner called Tyrone, which touches on this very point.
The way I've gone about it, I've just come out fighting. Fight as many people as I can, win as many fights as I can, so then I've proved what I needed to prove. Then I can go to someone and say, stop talking too loud at night because you're doing my head in. And they will stop. Not out of fear of repercussions, but you know what I mean? But because they will know that I've been around the block and I've done what I needed to do. So there's that respect. There's a hierarchy that has arisen. In any workplace or even amongst the staff, governors or whatnot, there's a hierarchy. So it's the same everywhere. Prisoners do whatever they need to do.
Well, there's the prompt for you. Tell me a little bit more about the hierarchy. I mean, you have the two expressions. You've got the king of the wing and the nerds. So tell me about that hierarchy.
Well, I think one of the things that's important to know is that the hierarchy is relatively fluid and dynamic, and it's actually relatively functional within the YOI and, of course, in adult prisons. The young men would evaluate each other, weigh, measure, test each other to establish each other's nerve, confidence, and they would also be assessing each other according to what they were wearing, the way they navigated the social world at the prison, whether they responded to disrespect or threats and how they answered, but also what was in their cell, whether they had toiletries and shower gel. And what we noticed was that there was the king of the wing, or the top dog as they were described, and these young men were often those who were controlling the illicit economy, so the flow of drugs, contraband, and something called canteen, which is sort of food and toiletries within prison. At the other end, the lower echelons of the prisoner hierarchy were the nerds, which were often a collective of people who were seen as weak or vulnerable or seemed quite scared within the prison, as well as those who were deemed as sex offenders or gay or transsexual, and they often were given fairly shameful names.
I mean, how much violence is going on all the time? I mean, there were lots of incidents all the time, but you don't want to say people weren't constantly fighting.
No, that's exactly right. People aren't constantly fighting. On average, there were at least one to two fights or assaults a day. Some of the fights and assaults, though, aren't recorded. So we don't always know what the dark figure is of prison violence is. What would happen, though, over time is young men would get used to the environment. Violence became quite normal and it became more predictable over time. So they would often be able to explain why violence occurred, which made it easier to navigate, which is why some people felt quite safe in that environment. For those people who were persistently targeted, and there were often a group of young men who were more vulnerable to that, it could be predictable and they could explain what would happen, but they would often live in constant fear.
How did you get the prisoners to talk to you about their experiences, I mean, relating to violence? It seems to me, I imagine people keeping very quiet about it, not wanting to implicate anybody else in acts of violence or whatever. How did you get them to talk to you?
Well, I think one thing that certainly helped was that we spent a lot of time in the prison. So they got to know us on the wings. We would hang around. We would stand around the wings, chatting to them late into the evening. And so some of that knowing us, knowing who we were, having checked us out, so they would be testing us to see whether we could handle that prison environment, that really helped. And over time, we found that some of the more influential young men, they would refer people to us, which was actually quite helpful. So they would sort of tell others about us and vouch for us, which we found helpful.
Well, I just want to ask you, because I really haven't asked you yet, but what sort of acts of violence? I mean, these are fights, punches, stabbings. What sort of things are we talking about?
So there was a real range. So there were the stabbings, there were the incidents that resulted in broken jaws, the sort of incidents that might end up in hospital treatment, but there were also the punches, the fights, but there was also a greater range of incidents that weren't about assaults and fights, which included robbery, theft, threats, social exclusion, but also to some limited extent sexual violence, and all these things work together. So there is a fluidity to a threat one day might lead to an assault the next, and someone being assaulted and them not being able to overpower them or being assaulted and it backfiring might lead to further acts of victimisation.
I mean, you do paint a pretty grim picture. So I've got to really ask you is, I mean, how representative was this young offender institution you studied? I mean, are all these institutions as violent as this, or was this a special case?
So this particular young offender institution was experiencing a particular problem with prison violence at that point. But I think it's true to say that at various times, other young offender institutions have seen similarly high rates of prison violence. One of the things I think that we could do a much better job of is really thinking about how we manage young men in prison and resourcing those prisons much, much better, and really thinking about the fact that they are maturing young men.
I rather imagine that quite a bit of this violence and trouble is there because there aren't enough staff to patrol the prison, to keep people separated from each other.
I think the reduction in staffing across the prison system has had a very negative impact on our ability to hold people safely. It's not just actually about staff being there to separate people, but it's also staff being there to, for example, fetch the toilet roll or notice when someone's having a bad day or notice when somebody is perpetually robbing other people or always seems to have all the food and the toiletries in their cell. And it's also about treating people well and recognising when they need additional support. And some officers are exceptional at this. They know they've got that emotional intelligence to know when people are having a bad day. But I think what's happened is with fewer staff are busier. They sometimes are more fearful, or they lack the phrase that we would always traditionally use is jailcraft. And all of these things combine to mean people feel like they're treated with less dignity, they're frustrated, perhaps their mental health is poorer because they're not out of the cell, or the things that are causing their mental health crisis aren't answered.
Yes, I want to come on to that, because although I was struck by the violence that was going on in prison, I was also struck by the very sensitive way in which you tell, if you like, the backstories of these young men. I mean, we're not talking about certain small things that might have happened to them in their lives, but we're talking about many of them having experienced major tragedies, serious events in their lives, which they can hardly be expected to cope with in normal times, let alone in a prison.
Yes, I mean, one of the encounters that we had about midway through the project was we were talking to one of the young men, and he very profoundly said, everyone in prison has scars. And for him in particular, what had happened was he was in prison for a very serious violent offence, for GBH with intent, grievous bodily harm with intent, which had been, he had done on the anniversary of his child's death. His baby was born, stillborn. And he would talk about the sort of impact of this trauma and this tragedy on his life even as he grew and matured. And we encountered many examples where people would describe holding their best friend as they lay dying in the street, or being stabbed themselves and realizing, as they put it, they had to sort of man up or learn to adopt violent strategies to protect themselves. And I use these examples in the book not to say that we should excuse the violent acts that people inflict on others or their crimes and their offending, but to recognise that unless we understand why people inflict violence, we can't prevent it. And also just how poorly, really, young men in prison are supported to help them with what is quite profound grief and loss, either before they come into prison, but as they live in prison. And as young men, 18, 19, 20 years old, these experiences were harrowing, but there was no one to talk to. They had to remain stoic and they had to control their emotion. There was no room for expressing that emotion and that pain as frustration or anger or fear.
And I congratulate you on conveying that dilemma very, very well. Yes, Kate Gooch, thank you so much. Now, I can't leave this discussion about the pains of imprisonment, the cacophony of noise, the fear of victimisation, the lack of colour, without adding in one other dimension. The alteration that prison imposes upon one's sense of time. And no one captured this element with more precision than novelist and Russian revolutionary Victor Serge. He wrote rather wonderfully, "Each minute in prison may be marvellously or horribly profound. There are swift hours and very long seconds. Past time is void. There is no chronology of events to mark it. External duration no longer exists."
Thinking Aloud was presented by Laurie Taylor and produced by Natalia Fernandez. There's archaeology, native and heritage breeds and baking in On Your Farm in a moment, after a look ahead to a new series starting tomorrow here on BBC Radio 4.
What if I told you that the chemicals used to make our everyday products are accumulating inside our bodies right now?
We're finding it in our beer, our tea, our wine.
I'm Mark Miodovnik, and I'll be investigating these hidden substances. From PFAS, the forever chemicals in our food, water and cookware, to the microplastics we inhale and ingest every day.
There was no food that I could find that didn't have the microplastics.
What harm are these chemicals doing, and can we avoid them? Toxic begins tomorrow morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The new leader of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, Richard Moth, will be giving his first interview to Sunday after the news at 7 o'clock. And as Ramadan and Lent get underway at the same time next week for the first time in decades, what could Muslims and Christians learn from each other's seasons of preparation and abstinence? Emily Buchanan is here in 40 minutes. Before that, to the far north of the British Isles for this week's On Your Farm with Rose Ferriby.
Hello.
Hello, Rose.
Oh, nice to meet you. How are you?
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Welcome to Garth's Croft on the island of Bressa.
Oh, it's so nice to be here.
Very much welcome to Shetland. The sheep are looking hungry today.
Yeah.
We have a fine day. Bit of a southerly wind. Beautiful blue sky.
Missed the storm.
That's yet to come. Yet to come. Never too far away from the wind. Come into the byre.
Thank you. This week's On Your Farm, I've come to Bressa, just off the mainland of Shetland, in the far north of Scotland. I've come to meet Chris Dyer, who's using his background as an archaeologist to diversify his croft in very interesting ways.
So, welcome to Garth's Croft. We are on the island of Bressa, which is to the east of Lerwick, the capital of the Shetland Islands. Shetland is an archipelago of over 100 islands, 16 of them inhabited, lying approximately 180 miles from Norway and approximately 200 miles north of the UK mainland.
And Chris, it's brilliant being here at the Croft. We can see across to Lerwick, actually, can't we, here in the distance, just standing in the entrance to your byre, just out of the wind. We can see the wonderful coastline, lovely big craggy cliffs with the waves breaking on them on the mainland there, and sort of closer to the lovely rolling, very washed out looking ambers and greens of pastureland and the lane coming up to the Croft. Can you tell me a little bit about Garth's Croft?
Yes, Garth's Croft is an agricultural settlement of around about 50 acres. My croft works so we have the best drained land, the land that's been used historically for cultivating crops. That's immediately adjacent to the croft house on the slight lower land. And then as you go uphill behind, we start to change onto acidic grasses and then increasingly onto peat and to moorland.
How did you come to be on Shetland in the first place? Where were you brought up originally?
I'm originally from Hitchin in Hertfordshire. And I studied university in Hull and worked as an archaeologist there for a number of years before a role came up as an archaeologist for the Shetland Museum. So I moved to the Shetland Islands and undertook that role, an archaeologist for the Shetland Museum, for around about 17 years.
So how did you go from your job at the museum, Chris, to taking on a croft?
Well, one of the things I sought to do very soon after moving to the Shetland Islands was to speak to local farmers and local crofters and to endeavour to try and get some form of experience. And for a number of years I worked on a farm on the island of Bressa from a very short seasonal point of view. It's kind of lambing seasons, to get that experience. It's something that was so endemic, so inherent within the Shetland Islands. So absolutely the passion was there in terms of the archaeology. You were sort of seeing the remains of agricultural settlements every day in your professional job. And now, crucially, it was being joined with some real-life practical experience. And then I was in a very fortunate position around about 10 years or so ago, and the croft came up. So it's called Garth's Croft today, but if you look at all the old paperwork, it's called the Garths of Kirkjubæster. If anyone travelling in Iceland or the Faroe Islands, Kirkjubæster in the Faroe Islands means farm of the church. So this croft means enclosure next to the farm of the church. And therein is a really interesting aspect that Shetland has looked east. It's looked towards Scandinavia.
How does crofting work in Shetland?
It's a very common facet that the vast majority of people who would term themselves crofters would have multiple forms of of employment, skills, and endeavours. It's a very attractive thing that I've always found about the Shetland Islands, that you're not defined by one role in life. I would define myself as an archaeologist. Some days I would define myself as a stonemason. Other days as a crofter, as an agriculturalist. So I was very enthused, inspired by the idea of principally the native breeds. These breeds are very, very interesting. They've certainly had a role to play for centuries going back. I have a particular interest in the colour and markings of the Shetland breed of sheep, which links wonderfully into so many different ways, into language, into place names, into dialect, and from a contemporary point of view, into things like knitwear and fibre and heritage traditions of the Shetland Islands.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing more of the croft and seeing how your archaeology is leading and influencing your crofting practice.
Excellent, Rose. Well, before you arrived, we got some sheep in. The rams are presently with the ewes, so let's go and check them out.
My goodness, that's hungry sheep.
Well, at this time of year, of course, we have the rams running with the ewes to give us lambs in the middle part of April. So yes, the grass quality has considerably gone back, and so even though this is a breed that is very much evolved to live with minimal human interaction, clearly anyone going past with a bucket or a bale of silage at this time of year draws some rather interested eyes. So yeah,
we're popular. They're really beautiful sheep. They seem quite chunky, but they've got quite aquiline faces and these lovely, bright, big eyes with the sort of horizontal line going through the centre. And their fleeces are such diverse colours. They're different shades of browns and very dark, ashy blacks and the whites and the beiges. They're really unusual to have this much diversity in fleece in just one flock here at the gate.
Well, absolutely. The Shetland breed of sheep, we're looking at one breed, but there are over 50 different colours and markings of this particular breed. So that's an interesting aspect from an agricultural perspective, because, of course, we tend, whether it's at a market level, to breed and to produce for uniformity, certainly in terms of what buyers are looking for. They're looking for consistency. My particular interest, born of the fact that agriculture was a proportion of what I do, I think that would be fair to say, is that because my everyday life, my income isn't derived wholly from agriculture, I have that ability to say, what do I want to do with my breeds? So this is a breed that doesn't retail in a particularly successful fashion, and yet there is a tremendous array of colours and markings. So that leads very interestingly into textiles and to fibre.
I'm very charmed by the fact that this lot are coming up and nuzzling us and got incredibly soft noses, and normally sheep aren't this friendly or charming. I don't know, maybe they are.
No, heady lining charming sheep here. No, really the principal aspect is from an agricultural diversification point of view, the reason of keeping the sheep relatively tame started out purely from a welfare perspective, to be able to get a hold of a sheep if it was exhibiting any problems, to be able to treat that sheep, but also now, crucially, a major selling point of Garth's Croft is to be able to welcome visitors, to do exactly as we're doing here, to be able to see, to engage, to feel the fleeces, to be able to understand where the fibre journey starts. And in order to do so, and in order to really engage with and appreciate that true array of colours that the Shetland breed exhibit, there is a deliberate policy of keeping the sheep relatively tame so that we can gather them quite easily in advance of visitors coming to the croft to actually see what agricultural life is like. What we're doing here today, when the sheep are very close around us in a pretty green field here, this is a very alien strategy. You know, 100 years or so ago, this would have been a field that would have been cultivated, or a hay park in the summer months. The Shetland breed would quite literally be baled up to the hill where they would survive on the coarser acidic grasses, heather. They're not a breed contrasted with the commercial crossbreed. If you put a Suffolk lamb on a heather-clad hill for the summer months, they're going to melt. They're going to come back. But whereas the Shetland breed, through evolution, is absolutely accepting of this. The rise of commercial sheep farming in the late 19th, early 20th century, driven by the estates, fundamentally impacts what we see today in terms of the cultural heritage, in terms of the ruinous remains of the croft houses, but also tells us some really quite fascinating stories. There were Shetlanders who left to go to North America, to Canada, to Australia, to New Zealand. Shetlanders have travelled the world, and the sea has always been the thing that has united them.
And Chris, that's a wonderful connection, you know, all these Shetlanders who've gone out in the past to all these people from different countries who are showing an interest in the wool, and the fact that your wool's going off to be woven into all kinds of products in California and other places. It's lovely, that idea of it going back out into the world again.
Yes, absolutely. Must be very cold in California, that's all I can think, to get a nice Shetland wool jumper. It's the most appealing aspect, and it's something that I'm very fortunate to be able to engage with. And obviously aspects today like social media play a crucial role in being able to reach those markets. And the markets are wholly independent. These are individual knitters, weavers, dyers, hand spinners they're supporting independents like myself. And there's no more heartening thing than a couple of years after you've perhaps mailed a fleece, sent a fleece away to California, and then you get a letter or you get an email or you get a picture of someone saying, well, you're not going to remember me, but a couple of years ago you sold me this, Murrit or Flecket or Bezugget fleece, and this is what I have created. So that's been a really interesting aspect, the fibre economy and the visitors that come to Shetland specifically because of the fibre economy. It's influenced me in a very basic way, I must say, but to knit, and that helps me from an agricultural perspective, because of course when I'm selecting rams, yes, I'm looking at colour and markings, but I'm also looking at crimp and staple, because I basically want to produce the fleeces that the hand spinners are looking for.
I love the idea, Chris, that your wool is literally knitting together a community. And Chris, do you shear on site?
Yes, I have. I have a setup here, so I have pens that I built around the back of the house, so I can drive the sheep in with dogs, and then take the sheep out of the pens and bring them through into the clipping shed. So we could go and have a look at that now.
We'll leave these guys to their lunch.
I'll get the gate.
Okay.
Just shut this up. Right, I'll get the dog.
Oh, she's a beauty. What's her name?
This is Bryn.
Hello.
This is Bryn, who's presently eating chicken food. So we'll head into the shearing shed and she'll follow. Come in.
Oh, nicely out the wind. Great. So we've come into Chris's shearing shed, where on the wall he's got lots of fleeces. Yeah. Do you do all the shearing yourself?
Yes, I do all the shearing there. Ewe lambs principally in sort of June, and then ewes in July and August. I enjoy it especially because it doesn't need to be predicated by speed. It needs to be predicated by taking the fleece off in such a way that if you're a knitter, a spinner, that fleece is intact and it can be graded and it can be sent overseas. And this very much also forms part of agricultural tours throughout the year. But in the summer months, if those days combine with fair weather, especially if it's a fibre group or a textile group, I'll get some sheep in here and shear them in front of the group.
It's lovely to see all those fleeces just pulled in there on the wall. It almost looks like either a very nice selection of different coffees or chocolates, sort of blacky browns through to white. And it must be lovely to see that going through its journey and what people are making with it, and all those different colours are forming in people's designs and patterns.
Absolutely, and it gives me an inspiration for, you know, what, where is my flock going? What direction am I taking it in? The fleeces tend to get sent to their new homes through the late part of the summer and into the early autumn, so that by now we're left with the fleeces that remain that either didn't make the cut or haven't been sold, and then we actually use those for mulching and for putting around bedding and for the areas that we're going to plant in the following spring in terms of our subsistence, in terms of our growing operations that we do here at the Croft. I'd love to show you what we do with the leftover fleece.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to see it.
Back out and hope this dog hasn't eaten the mince pies. Come on, up you go. Come on, dog.
So we've come up just behind the croft and we're standing huddled amongst lots of trees next to your polycrub. You can see up the hill. The light's just catching beautifully, isn't it? Lovely winter gauzy light, the low sun. And we can see the sheep and the sea just beyond us. And when did you start doing all this, Chris? It looks quite bedded in.
Well, this is an area that's a tremendous contrast to the vast majority of the land that you see around. As you see, we're enclosed with a dry stone wall and trees which are sort of getting on for three times the height of us. Now, I appreciate context is everything. Trees and the Shetland Islands are not natural bedfellows. About 8 or 9 years ago, I diked in an area around about 30 metres long by 20 metres wide. It was the first dry stone yard to have been built in Shetland for over a century, because, of course, traditionally these dry stone yards would be areas where the sheep would be excluded and would be tremendously important from a cultivation point of view. Now, rather than use it wholly for cultivation, seek to try and be a little bit creative and a little bit sort of linking back to the historical past. So planting trees, and they're principally willows, the Icelandic and felt-leafed willows, which of course are tremendously malleable. We experienced some pretty substantial westerly and southwesterly kind of Gulf Stream influence winds here. We're looking due west. The vast majority of these 70, 80 miles an hour gales will be hitting this area. But there are various ways we can combat that, and that is through almost artificially creating a system. And the way that I've chosen to do that is to build a polycrop. It's effectively a rigid greenhouse, and it gives us that ability to grow certainly salad crops and to grow fruit and vegetables all year round.
People might be imagining a polytunnel. This is the same form, the curved form, isn't it? But this looks like it's built for the gales.
It's essentially a Shetland greenhouse, and what it does, it enables us to get a fairly consistent temperature and comfortably in excess of 30 degrees throughout the summer months. So fruit trees are absolutely no problem, salad crops all year round. From my point of view, this is absolutely an environment where we can get our soft fruits, because, of course, outside, adjacent to the trees, outside we can do our root vegetables. But inside, this is where the polycrop really comes into the benefit from the growing operation. So we'll have all of the fruit trees, apples, pears and cherries and plums, raspberries, strawberries, and then through the summer months, so tomatoes, squashes, there's even a grapevine up at the top.
Wow! And Chris, you know, you're already doing the sheep, stonemasonry, archaeological tours, all sorts. Are you also running all of your fruit and vegetable production?
Well, I have a wonderful partner, Joanna, and she's really leading with the fruit and vegetables. So she's been extremely busy at this time of year using our excess sheep fleece and putting that down for mulch on the vegetable beds, getting some of those vegetable beds dug over in advance of planting. So she is the green fingers to my rather mucky sheepy fingers. So I think the kettle might be on inside, so we can go and say hello.
Oh, that would be really nice. I'd like to meet her.
Right, straight through to the kitchen, I think.
Hello.
Just a name of a catcher.
Oh, that's what I like to hear.
Can I get you a cup of tea?
That'd be amazing, thank you.
I'm Joanna Sanderson, I'm Chris's partner. For the last couple of years, I've mainly been just, I guess, growing my confidence in growing things in the polycrop, which you've seen today. Trying different things out in the kind of empty beds you've seen right now, which... Over the winter we've been putting in quite a lot of work to try to keep the soil quality good, and then planning ahead to what we're going to try next year. So as you've seen, there's trees that are established, some raspberry bushes, but apart from that, it's really a blank slate to try out what we think we might enjoy eating, what's going to get the best use out of our space, and what might be a bit of a challenge.
And what's your aim with this? Is this just for you two?
It's just for us, as far as we can help. If we have friends over, there might be some raspberries that go missing. Part of my time, one of the hats I wear is a little bacon sideline. So things like the raspberries are sometimes commandeered by me to fill cakes with. But apart from that, it is just really for the two of us. So our aim is to enjoy good food, and good food that we've put the effort into.
And Joanna, you're from Shetland, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Mm-hmm.
And you're from a farming background as well. How has doing things with Chris on the croft been different to what you're used to and what you grew up with?
Yeah, so I grew up on a sheep farm, primarily, kind of what we did on the farm there. And a few things, really maybe to finish off on the polycrop, that is a difference. So we weren't growing... and we didn't have the capabilities to grow things like fruit trees. So that, from a kind of food point of view, for me has been a real treat as somebody who just loves food and creating food, is being able to have the capability with something like a polycrop to expand what we're doing. And in terms of the livestock point of view, it's been really lovely to kind of see what Chris has kind of put his passion into. Seeing the kind of care that goes into breeding different colours and kind of patterns into the fleeces. And one of the kind of primary differences I feel and see is at lambing time. What is really lovely at the croft is when you wake up and see that the sheep has been able to do what nature intended and have the lamb or lambs, and also the surprise of what colours and markings have come through in the fleece. So you can have a little guess of what you think it's going to look like, and then it might be completely different. and they're really distinct then, the lambs, from one another by the markings. It's really nice to see the breed, as I say, just doing what they're built to do.
And you two, it's so lovely talking to you because you're both so experimental. You're doing so many different things and putting so many different skills together in interesting ways. What are you most excited about the coming years? What things would you like to be getting on with together?
I think it's just really exciting in terms of the croft, especially, that this is a purely evolutionary road. We haven't set out to say, right, we will design an agricultural diversification business and this is what it will be and this is how we will try and make a living. This has happened and is happening because of the various skill sets that we bring together. Certainly what I find most exciting is the opportunity that will come through the people that you meet and the people that we've met, whether it's knitters, whether it's tours that come to us. They are influencing us in how the flock moves forward in terms of what they're looking for in the wool, in the colours, in the markings, and just in the life observations, because you're always having to, you know, you're starting out at the same place every day, but the conversations go in a myriad of different ways.
I think following what makes us happy but also sparks curiosity, and with that comes some challenge and some hard work, but ultimately following what is enjoyable to us. And I think you can sense that, or you can feel your way through and usually tell when you're on the right path. So I think being open to whatever comes, but ultimately following what kind of feels good to us and feels like it's engaging for other people.
I think that sounds a good mantra for life, Joanna.
Rose Ferriby was on Your Farm in Shetland with Chris Dyer and Joanna Sanderson. Farming Today returns tomorrow morning, reporting on a comeback for oilseed rape and a shortage of vets who want to work on farms. Farming Today tomorrow morning at 5:45. Time for the weather now. Here's Simon King.
Richard, thank you so much indeed. After yesterday's sunshine, unfortunately, the cloud and the rain has returned. Overnight, we had some hill snow as well, which has mainly fallen over higher ground, but down to low levels this morning. You may just wake up across northern England into Scotland with a bit of a slushy mixture on the ground there, but that's going to turn back to rain thawing away pretty quickly. But as I said, pretty wet. So for southwest England and Wales, some pretty heavy rainfall around through this morning. As we go into the afternoon, the rain will tend to break up a little bit. There'll be some brighter skies, a bit of sunshine developing across Wales and southwest England, but equally still some showers, which could be heavy, maybe even a bit thundery as well, and maximum temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius. In southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, again, areas of rain around this morning. Some of that's really quite heavy at the moment across parts of the Midlands, pushing into southeastern areas of England. There could be a few drier spells, I think, as we go through the afternoon. But on the whole, it's going to stay cloudy with further outbreaks of rain and temperatures of 7 to 10 Celsius. In northwest and northeast England, overnight rain and hill snow. So, as I said, a few centimetres down to relatively low levels could bring a bit of disruption. Certainly over the Pennine routes, the higher routes in general, seeing some fresh snow, the risk of some ice. The snow will start to thaw out, though, as mild air moves in, and there'll be further rain at times through the day with maximum temperatures of 5 to 7 degrees. For North Ireland today, it's a dry start, but we'll see some occasional heavy showers coming in from the west, the odd thunderstorm as well, with highs of 7 or 8 Celsius. And across Scotland, fresh accumulations of snow over higher ground, some wet snow down to low levels. There should be some brighter spells, I think, around the northeast of Scotland, but otherwise remaining quite cloudy. Further rain, especially into southern Scotland later on, and top temperatures today getting to about 5 or 6 degrees Celsius.
Simon King, thank you. The 7 o'clock news is coming up after a quick word from Zoe Ball.
Before the anthems, before worldwide fame, before becoming a frontman, he was a drummer.
Really had no ambition to be a singer. I really didn't want to come out from behind the drums.
It's Eras, Phil Collins.
I'm Zoe Ball, and this is a story about an accidental icon.
If that divorce thing had never happened, I would never have started singing and writing in the way that I did, which means that Phil Collins' solo guy would never have happened.
It's the latest series of the Radio 2 podcast, Eras. Listen now on BBC Sounds. Just search Phil Collins.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 15th of February. Good morning. This is Tina Ritchie. A senior Iranian diplomat tells the BBC the ball is in America's court in negotiations about a nuclear deal. A Labour think tank that helped Sir Keir Starmer win the party leadership paid for research on the personal background of a Sunday Times journalist. The author of a major review of child gender services in England warns that young people have been weaponised in the debate about transgender rights. Iran's deputy foreign minister has told the BBC that the ball is now in America's court to prove it's ready to negotiate a deal over Tehran's nuclear programme. Speaking to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, in the Iranian capital, Majid Takhravanachi said his country could consider compromising if the US allowed discussions about a lifting of sanctions. A second round of talks this month will be held on Tuesday in Geneva. Lise Doucette is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
Mr. Takhravanchi said they were receiving messages in public and private that the US was interested in reaching a deal. But he expressed concern about President Trump's conflicting signals. In his latest comments, the U.S. leader said regime change would be the best thing to happen in Iran. Takhravanchi, who's playing a key role in this process, said that wasn't the message they were receiving in private. He also questioned America's military buildup in the region, warning that another war would be dangerous for everyone, especially for those who initiate the attacks. Yesterday, the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Mr. Trump preferred to negotiate, but a deal with Iran was very hard to do. Dr. Vanchi said they were ready to discuss compromises in their nuclear program to reach an agreement if the U.S. was prepared to lift sanctions now crippling Iran's economy.
The ball is in America's court. I mean, they have to prove that they want to have a deal with us. And if there is a sincerity, if we see a sincerity on their part, I'm sure that we will be on a road to have an agreement.
He expressed hope a deal was in reach, but said Iran had also taken every step to defend itself if it came to war.
The issue of nuclear weapons has been high on the agenda of world leaders at the Munich Security Conference. Russian aggression and fraying ties with the US have prompted discussions about whether arsenals in Europe should be expanded. Yesterday, the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, insisted that nobody was considering replacing the American nuclear umbrella. Here's our Europe editor, Katia Adler.
Russia and the US each have thousands of nuclear warheads, and China, already the world's third largest nuclear power, is said to be expanding its arsenal significantly. Britain and France are the only nuclear powers on this continent, which traditionally has relied on a nuclear umbrella provided by the United States. Washington insists that arrangement is not under threat. But President Trump's transactional approach to foreign relations has European nations nervous and looking to France and Britain to share their nuclear deterrence. President Emmanuel Macron has already engaged with Sweden, Poland and Germany about the role of France's nuclear weapons. He plans to make a major speech on France's nuclear doctrine later this month. At this weekend's Munich Security Conference, Sir Keir Starmer said the UK's nuclear deterrent already protects fellow NATO members, but he stressed he was enhancing nuclear cooperation with Paris. Scaling up nuclear arsenals would be costly, and government purses in France and the UK are already stretched.
A Labour group which helped Sir Keir Starmer win the party leadership paid for a report which investigated the personal and religious background of a Sunday Times journalist. Labour Together commissioned a US lobbying firm to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of a story about the think tank's donations. The resulting report, including details about the journalist's faith and upbringing. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
It was late 2023 when Gabriel Pogrant was one journalist behind a Sunday Times report on undeclared donations at Labour Together, the think tank considered to be behind Sir Keir Starmer's rise to party leader. At the time, the group was led by Josh Simons, now a minister in the Cabinet Office. He commissioned the US public affairs firm, APCO Worldwide, to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of the story. He has since said he feared a suspected illegal hack which had nothing to do with UK journalists. But the report that APCO delivered included claims about Mr. Pogrant's Jewish faith, his relationships and upbringing. Mr. Simons said the company had strayed beyond its brief. I was surprised and shocked to read the report extended beyond the contract by including unnecessary information on Gabriel Pogrant, he said. APCO did not respond to requests for comment.
The paediatrician who led a major review of NHS child gender services in England has told the BBC that some young people questioning their gender may have been misled by what they've seen on social media. Dr. Hilary Cass, who produced her report in 2024, told Sunday with Laura Kunzberg that children had been influenced by unrealistic images and expectations, and they may not have pursued medical treatments if they'd taken more time before making the decision. Dr. Cass said she believed young people had been let down in the debate about transgender rights.
Children have been weaponised.
Weaponised?
Yeah, I think so. By some people. By people at the extremes. The vast number of people in the middle are silent, but it's the people at the extremes who really have, I think, caused quite a lot of distress for young people, you know, even as there's been, you know, rhetoric in the press. It's frightening for young people.
Analysis from the union body the TUC suggests the gap between men's and women's pay in England and Wales won't close for another 30 years. The research says that although the gender pay gap has shrunk slightly every year since the pandemic, on average, a woman's full-time annual salary is £2,500 lower than a man's. Here's our business correspondent, Ben King.
The organisation says much of this shortfall is due to female workers' progression and earning potential being limited by working part-time to allow for caring responsibilities. The gender pay gap for full-time workers is smaller, close to 7%. Finance and insurance see the biggest gender pay gap at more than 27%, but the TUC says even female-dominated sectors such as education and health and social care also have large gaps. The TUC is urging the government and employers to make tough, ambitious plans to tackle the issue.
Team GB's first medal winner at this year's Winter Olympics, Matt Weston, will be aiming to add to his gold in Northern Italy later in the new mixed skeleton event. Weston became the first British man in more than 40 years to win gold at a Winter Games when he triumphed in the men's race. From Cortina, here's our sports correspondent, Andy Swiss.
After his victory in the men's skeleton on Friday, Matt Weston has the chance to make sporting history. He could become the first British athlete to win two medals at the same Winter Olympics when he races in the mixed team event, which is making its debut at these games. Team GB will have high hopes in another mixed team event, the snowboard cross. Charlotte Banks and Hugh Nightingale were the world champions in 2023, and Banks will be hoping to bounce back from her disappointing performance in the individual event. And Britain's curlers will be looking to build on their victories yesterday. The men's team faced Germany and then Switzerland, while the women's team are up against Sweden.
Well, now for a look at the morning papers. The Mail on Sunday leads on more claims about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor when he was UK trade envoy. The paper says that documents released by the US Department of Justice show he leaked sensitive information about the Royal Bank of Scotland to one of Jeffrey Epstein's advisers in 2010. The Mail says there's now a clamour of demands for a full investigation by police and ministers into his conduct while in the role. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has always denied any wrongdoing. Meanwhile, the Sunday Times quotes the Director of Public Prosecutions for England and Wales, Stephen Parkinson, saying that nobody is above the law. As the paper says, pressure grows for a full investigation into the former Duke of York. Mr. Parkinson tells the paper he has total confidence that detectives will examine any relevant evidence that would point to criminality. Charities warn in the Sunday Express that a rise in the state pension age will plunge more than 100,000 people into poverty. The paper says the pensionable age of 66 will rise by a month in April and keep increasing until it reaches 67 in March 2028. Age UK tells the Express that many of those affected are not aware of the changes and that it will crush a generation struggling with soaring bills. The Department for Work and Pensions says it's committed to tackling poverty among all ages. A UK exam board chief tells The Observer that children could be taking half of their GCSEs and A-levels on screens within a decade. Colin Hughes from AQA says replacing some pen and paper exams with digital assessments would make the system more secure and fairer, particularly for children with special educational needs. And that concludes our look at the papers.
And that was Tina Ritchie. Sunday worship in an hour's time comes from St. Olive Hart Street in the City of London with music from St. Martin's Voices and readings from St. Matthew's Gospel. Now, though, on BBC Radio 4, it's Sunday with Emily Buchanan.
Welcome to Sunday. The war surgeon David Knott on the maverick Christian organisation which enabled his first visit to Myanmar and the personal faith that keeps him going.
It's surprising. When I go into a dangerous situation, you know, I pray to myself. I pray to God and, you know, please help me get out of this situation or please give me strength to carry on.
Also in the programme, we hear from Richard Moff, a leading Catholic in England and Wales, a day after his installation as Archbishop of Westminster. And as Lent and Ramadan start around the same day for the first time in decades, we hear what a Muslim and a Christian have learnt from each other's religion.
Would even hear my own Catholic brethren say to me, you mean you're not eating? I'm like, no, it's because of the influence of people like Hadiza, not eating, not drinking.
Oh, wow.
from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Have you deepened your spiritual practice with a habit picked up from another denomination or religion? We'd love to know. Sunday at bbc.co.uk. The Church of England's National Assembly, the Synod, took place last week. Synods attract nothing like the attention they used to when I started covering religion. But this one did mark a historic moment with the first speech by a female Archbishop of Canterbury. Well, to tell us about this and the issues debated, I'm joined by journalist Tim Wyatt, who's recently written a book called Archbishop Sarah Mullally and 10 Urgent Challenges for the Church of England. For those who missed the Archbishop's speech, Tim, did it feel like a historic moment?
Yes, good morning. It certainly did. There was certainly a renewed interest in the press gallery, as you say. It's thinner on the ground than it used to be at the General Synods, but there was certainly lots of national broadcast media there interested in the first ever woman to preside over the opening of the General Synod. And she was very warmly received, I think, across the Synod chamber. There was a nice touch when Archbishop Stephen Cottrell, the Archbishop of York, who's kind of been holding the fort since Justin Welby resigned, who said, you know, it seemed that it would make a chief nurse would make a very good chief shepherd, in a kind of reference to her previous career in nursing. So, yeah, I think it felt like a big deal for sure.
Now, the other major talking point, I suppose, apart from the fact that she was making that initial speech, was that the Synod has wound up its nearly decade-long conversation about inclusion and sexuality, living in love and faith, and formally abandoned proposals for standalone church services for same-sex blessings, although some campaigners say this isn't the end of the road. Can you tell us about the debate and just explain what has actually been decided?
Yes, it all got a bit lost in the weeds. So Living in Love and Faith is the kind of brand name that the Church of England has been doing this exploration and consideration around same-sex relationships for, as you say, nearly 10 years. And the bishops brought a motion on Thursday, which was debated and eventually passed after a five-hour-long kind of marathon debate, which said, you know, we believe that we can't really make any further progress on this matter. And so they kind of turned the page on LLF, as it were. They said, implementing, as you say, those standalone services of blessings for gay couples would require a full synodical process ending in a vote of two-thirds supermajority required, and that majority just doesn't exist for the Liberal side on this present synod. So effectively the bishops have conceded that they can't go any further, and they're going to have to wind this up. Of course, the Conservatives respond, well, you're not really, because also in the motion was the idea that the bishops would set up a new, what they're calling a working group on relationships, gender and sexuality, which would continue these conversations on for a few more years into the life of the next synod, which is due to be elected later this year. So both the Liberals were upset that LLF was ending, and the Conservatives were upset that LLF was kind of continuing under a different guise.
So it sounds like a fudge.
A classic Anglican mushy compromise fudge that pleases neither side and angers everyone equally.
Right. And I understand people were quite emotional in that debate.
Yes, there were some really tearful, almost quite angry speeches, particularly, I think, from the progressives and some of the LGBT members of Synod. There's a real sense of kind of betrayal and disappointment that the bishops had raised hopes for. The LLF program was founded on this promise of what they called, quote, a radical new Christian inclusion. And there's a strong sense from the Liberal side that that had been failed to deliver, that the bishops had led them up the hill and then kind of abandoned them and marched them down again without actually achieving very much.
Okay.
But equally, we should say the Conservatives are also quite unhappy about what had been achieved.
Right. And what about other issues? Anything else that's sort of caught your attention?
There was an interesting piece of kind of church and state constitutionalia when the new process of disciplining naughty vicars, effectively, disciplinary tribunals, is widely discredited in the Church of England, so that they've been working through for years now on a new bill that would create a much more robust and healthier system for discipline. And that was all approved unanimously last year, but it's been knocked back to the Synod by Parliament after the group of MPs who were supposed to rubber stamp Synod legislation said they didn't like one element of it. And so there was a kind of slightly awkward moment when they had to reopen something that they'd already approved and make a kind of targeted amendment along the lines that Parliament insisted, which felt a bit strange and a bit embarrassing. But they did that quite quickly.
Okay. Fine. Thank you so much, Tim. I'm sure that there was more, but I'm afraid we have to stop there. Tim Wyatt, thank you very much. Ash Wednesday is next week when Christians start Lent, 40 days of fasting, prayer and repentance, marked by having ashes placed on their foreheads. Muslims will also begin Ramadan on the same day, although exactly when depends on the sighting of the new moon. This coincidence for two of the major Abrahamic faiths only happens once every three decades. We're going to be joined by an Islamic scholar and theologian, but first we hear from two friends who met as students at the University of Abuja in Nigeria. Hadisa is Muslim and now lives in the UK, while Lavina is Christian and lives in Nigeria. They've long supported each other through these seasons of abstinence.
My name is Dr. Hadisa Kiri Abdurrahman and I live in Lincolnshire.
I am Lavina Kayode in Nigeria.
I met Lavina either end of 91 or very early 92. I think I've always known about Lent. For me, I think knowing and having a friend, a close friend like Lavina, just really made me intimately aware of how it plays out in the everyday.
Yes. And for me, I've always known about Ramadan way back from primary school because we're surrounded by Muslims. And so there's no way you would not know about Ramadan. And then meeting Hadiza during Ramadan, we got to do things together. I mean, breakfast together. Even when I wasn't fasting, I would join them to eat, you know. And I could say that because of the Muslim fast, I learned to fast away from food.
For me, Ramadan is also about discipline. And I have always never liked the overeating because I feel like it defeats the whole purpose. So I may not be giving up chocolate, but I push myself. My only preparations these days is carving out my prayer corner. It's not food-wise, the preparation is spiritual for me.
Catholics, particularly, especially on the Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, we abstain from eating meat. And then every Friday during the Lenten period. And it's just because meat was seen as something special, something that not everybody could afford. So you bring yourself down to everybody's level.
I didn't know that was the reason. That's interesting. And it's just like, you know, again, the resonance is with Islam. And growing up in Nigeria and with Christian friends, and even now has shown me, I don't feel like Christians make a song and dance. And I say that with the utmost politeness. We do. For us, it's a bigger thing, I think, because it's also a pillar of faith. There's so much anticipation towards Ramadan and everything. And so you can't help but notice that it is Ramadan. Meanwhile, with Lent, unless you are deeply connected to someone who is Christian, like you know about Ash Wednesday, Shrove Tuesday, you wouldn't know that
like maybe 15 years ago, it became more like the Islamic fast for me.
I think you became stronger. Am I right in saying you became more devout as you've grown older? Yes, I agree as well.
I would even hear my own Catholic brethren say to me, "You mean you're not eating?" I'm like, no. It's because of the influence of people like Hadiza. Not eating, not drinking from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. I don't think I would be able to not do it. You get what I'm saying?
That's a next level devotion, though. I can imagine why other people will be like, oh, look, you're really not having anything. Whereas for them, they've just given up one thing.
Nobody said you must do it this way, but for me, yeah.
That's interesting. So for Lent and Ramadan to start together, it's a message about the things that unite us, all the ways that we are in sync.
I knew you would go there.
To be honest, I'm looking forward to, I think it's next year or the year after, when we have Christmas and Eid on the same day. That would be cool.
Hadiza and Lavina, well, have you deepened your spiritual practice after observing another denomination or faith? We'd love to know. Sunday@bbc.co.uk. Timothy Winter, also known as Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, is the founder of the Cambridge Muslim College. He joins us now. Can you just briefly explain to listeners why this period of fasting for Muslims follows the moon's orbit, while for Christians, Lent is fixed to the calculation of Easter?
Well, it's complicated. Both religions have a kind of archaic dimension in that they respect the sacrality of the movements of the solar system. The Muslim calendar is perhaps more strictly lunar, which means, of course, that the beginning of each month depends on the actual sighting of the moon, which in our latitudes is not always possible, particularly given the kind of miserable weather we've had in the last few weeks. But who knows? Maybe somebody will spot it. But it also means that because the lunar calendar is rather inconveniently shorter in its 12 months to the solar calendar, that Ramadan kind of creeps forward by about 11 days each year. So sometimes it's in the summer, sometimes, as now, it's in the depths of winter.
And fasting, we see fasting in many different faiths. Why is there this tradition of fasting in both Islam and Christianity? And does it sort of have the same aims?
I think it's one of the most primordial of human practices. Just about every religion I've studied sets great store by fasting. I think it has something to do with obviously self-discipline, basic human skills of self-mastery, of saying no, of passing by the water cooler on a hot Egyptian afternoon and not indulging. These are useful forms of getting to know oneself and being in charge of one's lower self. Also an act of penitence, simply saying sorry to the divine for the rubbish and particularly the overindulgence that many of us, myself included, are guilty of for the other 11 months of the year. And a certain development of a sense of reverence and gratitude towards the food and drink that normally we consume without a second thought, particularly in our kind of mechanized world of agribusiness and supermarkets and food deliveries to our front door. The breaking of the fast every day, and of course the Feast of Easter for Christians, are an opportunity really to remember what a miracle it is that we're sustained regularly by the gifts of nature, and to give thanks for that.
Although, of course, in the in Christian, many Christian countries, as those two friends were saying, they don't necessarily observe fasting usually as strictly as Muslims. I think that's all we've got time for, Timothy. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Timothy Winter. Bangladesh is entering a new political era. The Bangladesh National Party has swept to a two-thirds majority in parliament, with Tariq Rahman returning from 17 years in exile to become the prime minister of the Muslim-majority country. It's the country's first election since the 2024 uprising that removed Sheikh Hasina, and it comes after months of reported intimidation and attacks on Hindus, Christians and other minority communities. Well, I'm joined live by Debabani Majumdar from BBC Monitoring in Delhi. Tell me, Debabana, that the BNP has now won a sweeping majority. Are there now hopes for a period of stability?
Hi, Emily. Yes, there is. It was a landslide victory for the BNP, winning more than 212 seats out of 299 constituencies. So it was a very sweeping victory in that sense. And there are hopes that BNP is going to turn the tide of instability that we've seen, that was seen following the uprising in 24. And the things that is going to fill up the political vacuum that has emerged. And it is going to provide not just stability in terms of politics, but there will be stability for the economy, which is not in a very good shape. And it will also ensure and has promised to ensure that the rights of minorities will be protected and there will be justice for any atrocities against minority community in the country.
Well, that's certainly the hope, isn't it? But the Islamist party, Jamaat-e-Islamiyah, has surged to become the second largest bloc. How are Christians and other minority communities seeing these results? I mean, they've already been talking about intimidation and attacks. Do you think those are going to continue?
Coming on to Jamaat-e-Islami, the thing is that what was seen previously was when BNP and Jamaat-e-Islami were in alliance years ago, before Hasina regime took over. And at that time, obviously, there were a lot of incidents that were reported related to, you know, minorities. And that sort of continued. It's not like it was only during one period, but even during Hasina's time, this minor, you know, targeting minorities or incidents had continued. But the difference was Hasina was seen to be pro-India. And that's why the minorities were also seen to be pro-Hasina. So following the collapse of her government, what happened was the minority communities were targeted. But that is something that the interim government did not endorse. But that was a narrative that was running everywhere. And these concerns were very real, as has been highlighted by several or rights organizations. Now, what Jamaat has done following the 24 revolution, Jamaat has actually made an effort to rebrand itself because it was coming back from complete political sidelining during the Awami League era. So what they did was they this time they not only formed something called a Hindu cell to put forward the rights of minorities, but they actually nominated a Hindu candidate in one of the constituencies.
And, really? So the Islamist party nominated a Hindu candidate?
Yes, the Islamist party did nominate a Hindu candidate. So this was all an effort at rebranding itself. That is what several media outlets sort of monitored and reported. And especially in the days ahead of the elections, the Jamaat chief Shafiqur Rahman, he was very, very candid and, you know, stressed the point that, you know, despite a population which is predominantly Muslims, but only less than 10% of the population were a minority from the minority groups and ethnic communities. But he stressed that Bangladesh was a country of all people and there was no majority and no minority in the country. So he has made these efforts. But again, given the background and what has happened just after the revolution, people are very skeptical. And there's this organization, Bangladesh Hindu Buddhist Christian Unity Council, which has been very vocal about the situation of minorities. And they also highlighted that in January itself, there were 42 incidents of communal violence in which there were 11 killings.
Okay, well, certainly that's going to be something to monitor, isn't it? Thank you so much, Debabani Majumdar there from Delhi. It's nearly 7:30. Coming up, we hear from the new Archbishop of Westminster, Richard Moth. Bobsleigh events get underway at the Winter Olympics today, and one competitor says his Christian faith has helped him get there. Joel Fearon was a 100-metre sprinter, one of the fastest runners in UK history, who switched to bobsleigh, winning bronze for Team GB in 2014. He retired after his sister was tortured and murdered in her flat in Leicestershire 3 years ago, but he's returned to compete, this time for Jamaica, at these Games. He told BBC Sport's Alex Seftel that his family is still recovering from her death.
It was tough for all of us. We're all still dealing with it in our own ways. You know, I'm making an effort of just trying to do as much as I can and just make some kind of impact on the world while I can. I didn't think I would ever going to be able to do sport again, and that's the reason why I did retire, because, like, you know, I really struggled with anxiety and I was becoming really, like, just afraid to leave my family alone. And, you know, because of the way my sister died and how it all happened, it was really tragic to me. So the fact that I'm out doing this and being able to do some of the stuff that I'm doing, I'm still quite proud of myself, and I'm happy to see myself coming back and to feel like myself.
That's really good to hear. I wonder whether your Christian faith has played a part in any of this, sort of keeping you sane or giving you some guidance at difficult times.
Yeah, no. Well, I think it's actually gave me peace, you know. I think that my I could be filled with sort of anger, and I could be filled with, you know, all kinds of emotions. But I think it's you know, it's gave me peace. It's let me know that my sister is all right. She's, you know, she's no longer in pain. She's no longer afraid. She's safe. And she's waiting for all of us to come spend some time and catch up. So, yeah, so it's definitely gave me peace of mind and helped me to make good decisions in times where, I guess, mentally, I wasn't as solid as I am now. It's helped me just to keep me directed and keep me doing right and being the person I'm supposed to be and not allowing the world around me to change me.
Joel Fearon. A striking symbol of that intersection of sport and Christian faith is the cross of the athletes, and it's been a regular fixture at Summer and Winter Olympic Games since London 2012, thanks to the support of the Catholic Church and the man who made it, Suffolk-based artist John Cornwall. I asked John to tell us what it looked like.
It's a procession cross made of 12 different pieces of wood, which were sourced from around the world. So they all look very different in terms of sort of colour, grain and that sort of thing. And then in the middle of the cross, there is a hollowed out corpus. So the image of Christ has been removed from the cross. Sort of a bit of a play on the God-shaped hole, if you like. They wanted it to be a sort of resurrection cross, but this was originally a very ecumenical project. So obviously it couldn't be a crucifix. It needed to be something that represented Christ without, you know, putting an image there. So it was removed in order to reflect anybody who looked at it.
Did you just decide to make this cross, or were you asked to do it?
Yeah, I was asked to do it by an organisation called More Than Gold, which was a Churches Together initiative before the London 2012 Olympics. I had just finished a previous artwork, a Body of Christ cross that was made up of 144 timbers, and I was commissioned pretty much straight away. And I said, well, actually, to represent these nations, I want to include X, Y, and Z. They were so touched by that that it then reappeared as something that they wanted in Rio de Janeiro and has been a feature of most of the Olympics since then.
What kinds of wood are in there?
So the 12 pieces, quite deliberately, we wanted to reflect all of the continents that would be present at the Olympic Games. So we wanted to make sure that there's some olive wood from the Holy Land. There's something called the Tree of Paradise. Anything that had a mythology or a story that went with it, we tried to include that. One is a piece called Gimlet, which to my mind is one of the ugliest pieces of wood in the world. And looking at the 12 disciples, we wanted to have something very imperfect within that. So we included that as one of the pieces.
What, representing Judas?
Yeah.
How did you create it? What was the process?
Oh, that's a great question. I had the time and wanted to do it myself. But I was also at the same time running a youth centre. I was involved in youth ministry. And maybe by coincidence or just the Holy Spirit in action, I was asked whether we could look after a number of students who were sort of at risk of expulsion. They were on the wrong tracks. And could they spend the time at the youth centre? So actually I ended up directing them, you know, quite carefully in producing this.
So what, they were literally sawing the pieces of wood, were they?
Yeah. Sawing them down. We sanded everything by hand. The inside aspect of this was all done in very careful gold leaf. Yeah, so something that they were each individually incredibly proud of. And when we heard that it wasn't just one of the many pieces that would be involved in the 2012 Games, but every 2 or 4 years, whether it's at a Winter or a Summer Olympics, we're all sent this story around saying it's now in Rio, it's now appeared in France, now it's in Milan. Yeah, it's a source of great pride.
How is it chosen? Well, how is the church chosen? Because it's only in one church at the moment. It's in a church in Milan.
It is, yeah. It'll always be quite central. It's always a church for the athletes and attendees. And I know 2 years ago when they chose the church in Paris, it was a church dedicated to Mary Magdalene. And the thought behind that was that Mary Magdalene, being the first person to see the resurrected Christ, ran straight back to the disciples. And so they sort of nominally said that Mary Magdalene could be a patron saint of short distance runners.
she was doing the first sprint.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit tenuous, but it was a lovely thing that actually that there's often that the Olympics gives the church a new lens to look through. And this wonderful, you know, everybody from every nation coming together. This cross was a real effort for the disciples to go out to all nations. And it's really lovely that the Olympics actually lets all nations come to us. And the cross can be central to that.
John Cornwell on the cross of the athletes. We've spoken recently on Sunday about orthobros, young men who are attracted to a hyper-masculine version of Orthodox Christianity. A Radio 4 documentary is now exploring a similar phenomenon in Islam. It's examining how so-called Dawa bros, influencers who claim to spread the word about their faith online, are impacting the lives of women and how women are fighting back.
It's painful to see them use Islam to fit their own narrative instead of embodying its true compassion and justice. One rule for you, another for them.
Education is literally ruining our sisters. Most of them don't even know how to run a household.
I see sisters nowadays, Allahu Akbar, flamingo eyebrows, eyelashes.
The Dawa Bros are a loose collective of online Muslim influencers, and they are driving a social media movement, one that they say is all about spreading a message of Islam. Fawzia is a 22-year-old Muslim from Yorkshire. For her, moving away from home and going to university was about more than just getting a degree.
I was brought up in a town where there was not a lot of ethnic minorities. So I was really excited to go to university and meet more Muslim men. So whenever I would speak to them about the issues within that, I would suggest different events, opening of spaces, being used more by women. I would always be dismissed in a way. They were like, oh, we don't have space because the brothers need to use that.
ISOCs are Islamic societies, hubs for Muslim students to build a sense of belonging whilst at uni. For Fawzia, though, she felt pushed out for being a woman.
I would hear often, it's kind of a fitna, which means even our presence being there was arousing for them. And it, no matter how much I tried to accommodate them and be more submissive and to be more Islamic in my head, it wasn't good enough for them. Like, I tried to be that, a quieter version of myself as a Muslim woman.
Many of the problems plaguing modern society stem from this death of modesty at the altar of maximizing individual rights at all costs. This is irrational. Islam provides a better way.
Critics of the Dawa Bros say that they are weaponizing Islam to generate controversy and money online. Renesha Khan is a lecturer at King's College London.
Dawa Bro is essentially a male social media native preacher influencer, part street debater, part podcaster, part internet commentator. But generally speaking, he's not trained as a traditional scholar, he performs authority through a kind of confidence, and also these clips and gotcha moments that are so kind of easily cached online, and also a tight aesthetic of certainty.
And you can hear more of that documentary later today, Beyond the Feed, Muslim Women and the Dawa Bros, presented by Amber Hack. It's on Radio 4 at 1:30 this afternoon and on BBC Sounds. The celebrated war surgeon David Nott, nicknamed the Indiana Jones of surgery because of his work in some of the world's most dangerous conflict zones, has just returned from rebel-held areas of Myanmar. Formerly known as Burma, the country has been gripped by a brutal civil war in which 3 million people have been internally displaced, and latest figures suggest tens of thousands have been killed in the fighting, including thousands of civilians. David Nott's trip was made possible by a group called the Free Burma Rangers. They're led by former U.S. Special Forces soldier and ordained minister Dave Eubank.
Kanye, what happened? What happened, Ranger? You get shot or just get shot?
On the shoulder.
The Lord protect you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Enemy's about 400 meters up. We have a 100-meter place. We get very close to drag them back. And Lord, please protect everyone here in Jesus' name. Thanks for praying. This is 6 February 2026, Free Burma Ranger. We need God's help. And bless the Burma Army, too, to leave. That's my prayer.
So, David Nott, you actually filmed that, didn't you? And you were on your way to go and try and do some of your extraordinary surgical work in the jungle. Can you just tell us what it was like going in there under fire?
Yes, so we arrived and went over the border from Thailand into Myanmar by a boat and then up the river for 11 hours until we reached a little village, which was where sort of like a base where the Free Burma Rangers were. And we stayed there for a while. And then we heard from Dave Eubank that there was a fight going on very shortly, and he wanted the surgical team to get up there with the Free Burma Rangers, who are the most incredible paramedics I've ever met in my life. And so we did. In the middle of the night, we packed our stuff up, we got into the jungle, and we set up very early in the morning an operating base with two tables that we found, and we had our equipment with us. And it was quite an incredible moment, I think, of my life, really, to realise that there was, you know, a fight going on between the resistance fighters and the Burma army, an intense, really difficult and dangerous fight. But the most amazing thing was that you had the Free Burma Rangers, who were this incredible group of people who were strong and vigilant, that went between the front lines fighting to pick up the wounded and brought them back to our operating table, which was in the middle of the jungle. It was quite an incredible feat.
Well, can I bring in Dave Eubank here? So you set up the Free Burma Rangers, and it seems that you go to places that sort of ordinary aid agencies just couldn't reach. It would just be too dangerous, wouldn't it, for the Red Cross, say, to be there?
So we started Free Burma Rangers about 30 years ago, and our idea was to give help, hope, and love to people in need. And it started out very small in Burma. I'll help one person, and they'll hopefully be glad, and I'll be glad, and that's it. And then ethnic people started to join us, and we only have three rules. You can't run if people can't run. And we're not a militia, we're not paramilitary, we're not there to fight. We can defend ourselves, but that's rule number one. Number two, you got to be able to read and write. You can't do quality medicine if you're not literate in any language, some language. And the third is do this for love, because we don't pay the teams. It's all volunteer. And since that time in Burma, we have 150 teams active now in different parts of Burma. And we've then gone to, we're in the Battle of Mosul in Iraq, kind of like you said, because we would go. And in Syria, with the last stronghold of ISIS, Baghouz, we were there when the Turks supported the FSA to invade in 2019. We were there. One of our team members from Burma was killed there. We've lost 78 of our team members killed and over 200 wounded. And we're now working a little bit in Ukraine, a couple of missions a year to help them medically and their chaplain program. So we're in different places. But this last mission, I can't believe these quality people come here and help. And again, with such humility, and I don't know if David will say it later, right after we got done, a jet fighter came in and bombed us and then strafed us. And when that was over, there was no rush to get out. It wasn't like David and his group were like, we got to leave now. I thought only later I figured out this guy's been in lots of wars.
And Dave, you mentioned that what you're bringing is love. That is, I mean, how important is your religious motivation behind what you're doing?
Well, for me, Jesus just changed my life, changed my heart. And I tell people we're doing this, number one, because we believe this is what God has for us. At least I raised my kids here. My wife, actually, she's right next to me here. My kids all grew up here. And if it wasn't love, we wouldn't do it. And so number one, it's spiritual, what we feel God has for us. Number two, it's emotional love. We love these people. They love us. Number three, it's intellectual. You know, oppression is wrong. Anywhere you face it, you can't beat all oppression, but you can face what's in front of you. And then last is physical. I was an ex-Ranger and Special Forces officer in the American Army. And I like to climb mountains and surf and skydive. We compete in rodeos. We race horses. I love all of that. So that's there too, but that should be the last. It should be God first, and then my heart, my mind, and then the body can follow. And that is my motivation. But you don't have to be a Christian to be in Freedom Rangers. We have Buddhists, atheists, agnostics, Muslims, spirit worshipers, all kinds of people.
Yeah, and David, then, does faith come into this work? I mean, you're doing this under unbelievable risk and danger.
Yeah, I mean, I am a Christian and, I go to a Welsh Baptist church every Sunday morning and enjoy being involved in the religious community. But, you know, I've done this as well as Dave has for 30 years or so and been to many, many war zones. It's surprising. When I go into a dangerous situation, you know, I pray to myself, I pray to God and, you know, please help me get out of this situation, or please give me strength to carry on, because it's so important that you have some sort of guiding light, that when you're in a very dangerous situation, that you can fall back on somebody. You know that somebody's there. It's not your mother and father because they're not with you, but it is the father, that he's there to support you. And I do it very, very often. But this time I felt really something more than what I have done over the past 30 years. I really felt this was a beautiful relationship between everybody that worked with the Free Burma Rangers, that were blessed by Dave before they went into the most dangerous situation, and to feel Dave praying for us and saying, you know, the Lord look after everybody here because they're doing a wonderful job. I've never met anybody like Dave Eubank before, and I've never been in a situation whereby his grace and overall humanity and awareness of family was so strong. It was certainly a massive eye-opener for me to realise that faith had such an important part for all of us, not just, not just in my head. It was for all of us.
You know, we've treated enemy soldiers, many of them here. I've taken care of ISIS afterwards. I fought them. I also took care of them. And I don't think I could do this without God. For me, I can't. For me, it's as long as I feel God leads me, and my wife and my kids and my team agree, because we do everything mutually. Yes, do this for love. And, you know, just today, David, just so you, that bridge you crossed, the big one, over the Salween River on your way out, just got blown up. And so it hasn't got any better. And I'm just grateful that people like David Knott, they give not only life-saving help that I saw with my own eyes, but they train other people to give life-saving help. And in addition to that, it's hope. Hey, we're not forgotten. This guy came all the way out here to do this with us. We're not forgotten. And so as long as God has us here, as long as the people welcome us, we'll stay.
Dave Eubank talking to us from the jungle in Myanmar, and the war surgeon David Knott safely back in London.
On behalf of the presidents of the churches together in England, it is my privilege to offer you a word of welcome today, as we give thanks for your calling and look ahead to our shared in life and witness. We thank God for your yes.
The new Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, welcoming the new Archbishop of Westminster, the leader for 4 million Catholics in England and Wales. The Most Reverend Richard Moth was yesterday installed in this post in front of 2,000-strong congregation in Westminster Cathedral, which included bishops and clergy from all over the country. And he joins us now. Good morning. What was it like, Archbishop, sitting in that huge cream-coloured throne and being passed the crozier from your predecessor, Vincent Nicholls?
Well, good morning. Thank you for welcoming me onto the programme. It was an extraordinary day yesterday.
a day of real joy, great solemnity, deep prayer, as you've mentioned, joined by a very large congregation in the cathedral and thousands joining us online as well. So, yes, an amazing day, amazing day.
And it must feel a huge weight now. I mean, you've got an enormous job. You've gone from one diocese to being responsible for the whole of England and Wales. Is there anything you're going to take into your role from any of your predecessors? I mean, Cardinal Hume, after all, was a Benedictine monk, and you too have an association with the Benedictines.
Yes, no, I think there is a lot. Of course, there's a lot on which to build that is so wonderful, the work of not just previous archbishops of Westminster, but so many lay faithful and the clergy around this diocese as well, and those with whom I'll engage nationally. So there's some tremendous foundations on which to build. I think one of the things I certainly shall be bringing from my experience in my former diocese is some of the work that we did there, engaging everybody in the diocese, clergy and laity too, in the church's mission in a very active way. And there's some, I think, some useful lessons that I've learned there that I'll be bringing here to Westminster.
Well, you quoted Pope Benedict in your homily yesterday, and you said, "Let us not be afraid to shine the light of the gospel in the public square." Now, of course, Cardinal Hume was one archbishop who was often in the public square, often on the radio. How outspoken are you going to be?
I'm not sure I'd use the word outspoken. That's not quite my style, I don't think. But I'm always very willing and keen to engage in that space, and have done a fair bit recently in the on the theme of criminal justice and the situation in our prisons. I think the church has a very, very significant role in bringing the gospel into the various situations that we see in the world and in our society. And that's what I mean by shining the light. You know, whatever the situation is, the gospel, the teaching of Christ has something to say in every one of those situations.
Isn't there,
and that's where that engagement takes place.
Yes, but isn't that, I mean, now that you are sort of, in a sense, a figurehead as well for the whole country, not just for Catholics, isn't there a sort of a need for moral leadership? Do you see yourself in that role, speaking strongly on problems of poverty, homelessness, prisons, whatever?
Yes, I do, and that's really what I mean by this thing of shining light. You know, it's not me in a sense that is the message here. It's the message of Christ, and it's my task as the Archbishop to bring that teaching, that light of Christ, into those situations. And there isn't one in which there is nothing to offer, if that makes sense. There's always something to bring of the gospel into every situation in our lives. And sometimes that might mean speaking quite strongly. Sometimes I think it means speaking in quite a nuanced way too.
And inevitably, when archbishops speak out on any social issues, they get criticised, don't they, for being too political. Are you tough enough, do you think?
I think so. And I have been criticised in the past for some of the things that I've said about our need to welcome refugees. Some of the things that I've said, certainly in my previous diocese, in regard to the care of our common home, I've been criticised about that, but it's not stopped me saying anything.
Now, you were Bishop of the Forces. What is your reaction to Keir Starmer yesterday in Munich saying, "We must build our hard power, we must be ready to fight to protect our way of life"? Knowing what it's like in the Forces, and you've been Bishop of the Forces, what do you feel about that?
Well, it's the task of any government to defend its borders and to care for its people and make sure that they are safe. I think many people in this country are aware that our defence spending, perhaps in the past, has been a little lower than it might have been, for good reason, or for not suggesting at all that the reasons for that were misguided. But perhaps at this moment in time, that needs some review. I'm also very conscious that we need, I think, better care and better facilities for our forces' families, because without that, It's very difficult for those who find themselves on the front line to get the support that they need. So there is work to be done in those areas.
Okay, and can I just turn now briefly to the quiet revival of church going, although figures are disputed on that. You've seen evidence of it yourself, haven't you? Why are some, mainly young men, joining congregations?
Well, I think there are probably many reasons for this. I think for some, it's a search for something other than what we're seeing around us in so many ways. A search for the transcendent, an awareness of something beyond ourselves, a realization that God is present everywhere that we are. Okay. It's a whole raft of things, I suspect. Okay. In terms of this quiet revival about which people speak,
I think history will tell. Yes, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm so sorry, Richard Moth, Archbishop of Westminster. We're just out of time. That's it for this week's Sunday. William Crawley is here next week.
Sunday was produced by Catherine Murray and Katie Davis. Now, the Ambassador for Samaritan, Scarlett Moffat, presents this week's Radio 4 appeal. And a warning, it includes discussion of suicidal thoughts and feelings.
This is the story of Layla. She's 28 and looking forward to her forthcoming wedding. Layla recently ran her first marathon in support of Samaritans and in memory of her mum, who she lost to suicide when she was just 7. They'd been close, she was a mummy's girl, and understandably her death left Layla devastated, and it was to affect her for many years to come. As a teenager, a time when she was trying to make sense of her mum's depression, Layla became plagued with thoughts that she too would one day take her own life, just as her mum had done. And as the years passed and Layla's depression and intrusive thoughts got worse, she found it harder to open up to friends and family. Grown increasingly isolated from those around her, she didn't know where to turn. Until late one night in 2017, a night she describes as really terrible, Layla made a call that she says changed the course of her future. It was two Samaritans. Hearing the ringing tone, she thought no one would pick up. But they did. And when she heard a voice on the end of the line who asked how she was feeling, the tears began and Layla just cried and cried. The call was, she says, a huge relief, a conversation that felt like she was taking a few steps back from the ledge in her mind. Layla says that call saved her life. Samaritans trained volunteers answer calls like this every 10 seconds over the phone or via online chat. I reached out to Samaritans during a dark time in my own life. Feeling alone, the voice at the end of the line helped me see a way forward. Their support gave me a different perspective and helped me see a better future. People who contact Samaritans often feel desperate, but the charity's network of 20,000 trained, listening volunteers are there to respond to calls for help all day, every day. It costs nearly £100,000 a day to run this vital service, and anything you can give today will help Samaritans continue to pick up every call and respond to every message. To donate, just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Samaritans and send it to Free Post BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. Importantly, please mark the back of your envelope, Samaritans. Thank you so much.
Scarlett Moffat. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles. You can find details for giving online if you search BBC Radio 4 Appeal. If you're a UK taxpayer and you want Samaritans to collect gift aid on your donation, include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. And if you've been affected by issues raised in this week's appeal, you can find a list of organisations who may be able to help at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Time for the weather now. Here's Simon King.
Thank you so much indeed. Good morning. Quite a messy weather picture across the United Kingdom through today. We've got some rain and some hill snow, which could cause some disruption for some over the next few hours with a few slushy accumulations down to low levels. But we'll start off in southwest England and Wales, where there's a lot of rainfall around this morning. It is just mostly rain as mild air is pushing its way in. We might see a few brighter spells developing later on into the afternoon, but still the threat of some showers, which could turn heavy, maybe even a little bit thundery, and temperatures get to about 9 to 11 Celsius. For southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, some heavy rain this morning, and it's mixed in with a bit of sleet and some wet snow pushing eastward. Now, for a time, we could see some pretty slushy accumulations, maybe a couple of centimetres, even down to some low levels as we go through into this afternoon, especially around parts of Lincolnshire and East Anglia. There is a Met Office yellow warning in force here. Some travel disruption could be possible. It will tend to ease off later on, and maximum temperatures really only about 5 to 7 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, we've had the overnight rain and hill snow, so waking up to a few centimetres perhaps, even down to low levels, but milder air is moving in. Most of that will tend to melt away. We will still see some cloudy skies, still further outbreaks of rain at times throughout the afternoon, and temperatures of 5 to 7 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, a dry start, but occasional heavy showers, the odd thunderstorm here, 7 or 8 degrees. And for Scotland, again, some fresh accumulations of snow over higher ground, wet snow to low levels. It will stay fairly cloudy for most. Further outbreaks of rain are likely, but some brighter spells in the far northeast. Temperatures are 5 or 6 Celsius.
At 9 o'clock here on Radio 4, it's Broadcasting House. Paddy O'Coles here. Morning.
That will be me, Richard.
And that's you, yeah.
Hello, and good morning to you. Thank you very much. Good morning. Well, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's time as UK trade envoy should be investigated. So the former business secretary, Sir Vince Cable, tells the Mail on Sunday. We'll report on that. Labour's walked back from the brink over the frenzy over the PM's job. Is it fair to blame political journalists for stoking the whole thing? Are we hooked on replacing the PM? Our listener is swapping his white-collar job for plumbing. He's in to tell us why, and we review the new Wuthering Heights to ask if it's more hanky-panky than Bronte, with James Henry, the TV writer, Gráinne Maguire and Isabel Hardman.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 15th of February. Good morning. This is Tina Ritchie. A senior Iranian diplomat tells the BBC his country is ready to compromise with the US on its nuclear programme if Washington agrees to discuss the lifting of sanctions. A Labour think tank that helped Keir Starmer win the party leadership paid for a report which investigated the personal background of a Sunday Times journalist. The author of a major review of child gender services in England says unrealistic images on social media have misled young people. Iran's deputy foreign minister has told the BBC that the ball is now in America's court to prove it's ready to negotiate a deal over Tehran's nuclear programme. Speaking to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, in the Iranian capital, Majid Takht-Ravanchi said his country could consider compromising if the US allowed discussions about a lifting of sanctions. A second round of talks this month will be held on Tuesday in Geneva. Lise Doucette is reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
Mr. Takht-Ravanchi said they were receiving messages in public and private that the US was interested in reaching a deal. But he expressed concern about President Trump's conflicting signals. In his latest comments, the US leader said regime change would be the best thing to happen in Iran. Takht-Ravanchi, who's playing a key role in this process, said that wasn't the message they were receiving in private. Takht-Ravanchi said they were ready to discuss compromises in their nuclear program to reach an agreement if the US was prepared to lift sanctions now crippling Iran's economy.
The ball is in America's court. I mean, they have to prove that they want to have a deal with us. And if there is a sincerity, if we see a sincerity on their part, I'm sure that we will be on a road to have an agreement.
He expressed hope a deal was in reach, but said Iran had also taken every step to defend itself if it came to war.
The issue of nuclear weapons has been high on the agenda of world leaders at the Munich Security Conference. Russian aggression and fraying ties with the US have prompted discussions about whether arsenals in Europe should be expanded. Yesterday, the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, insisted that nobody was considering replacing the American nuclear umbrella. Here's our Europe editor, Katya Adler.
Russia and the US each have thousands of nuclear warheads, and China, already the world's third largest nuclear power, is said to be expanding its arsenal significantly. Britain and France are the only nuclear powers on this continent, which traditionally has relied on a nuclear umbrella provided by the United States. Washington insists that arrangement is not under threat, but President Trump's transactional approach to foreign relations has European nations nervous and looking to France and Britain to share their nuclear deterrence. President Emmanuel Macron has already engaged with Sweden, Poland and Germany about the role of France's nuclear weapons. He plans to make a major speech on France's nuclear doctrine later this month. At this weekend's Munich Security Conference, Sir Keir Starmer said the UK's nuclear deterrent already protects fellow NATO members, but he stressed he was enhancing nuclear cooperation with Paris. Scaling up nuclear arsenals would be costly, and government purses in France and the UK are already stretched.
A Labour group which helped Sir Keir Starmer win the party leadership paid for a report which investigated the personal and religious background of a Sunday Times journalist. Labour Together commissioned a US lobbying firm to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of a story about the think tank's donations. The resulting report included details about the journalist's faith and upbringing. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
It was late 2023 when Gabriel Pogrant was one journalist behind a Sunday Times report on undeclared donations at Labour Together, the think tank considered to be behind Sir Keir Starmer's rise to party leader. At the time, the group was led by Josh Simons, now a minister in the Cabinet Office. He commissioned the US public affairs firm, APCO Worldwide, to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of the story. He has since said he feared a suspected illegal hack which had nothing to do with UK journalists. But the report that APCO delivered included claims about Mr. Pogrant's Jewish faith, his relationships and upbringing. Mr. Simons said the company had strayed beyond its brief. I was surprised and shocked to read the report extended beyond the contract by including unnecessary information on Gabriel Pogrant, he said. APCO did not respond to requests for comment.
The paediatrician who led a major review of NHS child gender services in England has told the BBC that some young people questioning their gender may have been misled by what they've seen on social media. Dr. Hilary Cass, who produced her report in 2024, told Sunday with Laura Kunzberg that children had been influenced by unrealistic images and expectations, and they may not have pursued medical treatments if they'd taken more time before making the decision. Dr. Cass said it was vital that a controversial trial of puberty blockers, which suppress the production of sex hormones, went ahead for under-16s.
We don't have any evidence at the moment that puberty blockers are irreversible, but these children who are on this trial will be about the most closely monitored you could imagine, and any hint that there are significant long-term risks, they would come off the trial. So it's really, really important, because otherwise, if we never answer this question, we're going to have ongoing charlatans just handing out inappropriate drugs.
Health officials say several children have been treated in hospital after what they're calling a big measles outbreak in North London. About a third of cases reported this year in England have been in the London borough of Enfield. Zoe O'Brien reports.
Figures show there were 95 laboratory confirmed measles cases in England in January. 35% of them were in the North London borough of Enfield. Most were children aged under 10. GPs in the area have confirmed infections at seven schools in Enfield and neighbouring Haringey. One in five of those who contracted the highly contagious virus was treated in hospital, but those figures could be higher because of data lags. The UK Health Security Agency called the spread of infection a big outbreak and urged anyone whose child hasn't had both doses of the MMR vaccine to act quickly.
Four astronauts have docked at the International Space Station, replacing a crew that had to leave earlier than planned last month because of a medical emergency. The new crew, which is made up of two men men and two women from America, France and Russia will conduct experiments over the next 8 months, including on the effects of microgravity on the human body. One of the marquee fixtures in cricket will get underway this afternoon when India play Pakistan in the group stage of the T20 World Cup. The match between fierce rivals in the Sri Lankan capital Colombo nearly didn't happen after Pakistan threatened a boycott. From Colombo, here's our cricket reporter Henry Moran.
India versus Pakistan is always a huge occasion, and this fixture has particular weight given the recent tensions that almost saw the game postponed. Until just a week ago, instructions from the Pakistan government had agreed to the side participating in the tournament, but not this particular match. Frantic meetings ensued. The monetary value in TV revenue and sponsorship on this fixture is immense, and eventually it was agreed that Pakistan would play. So all eyes on Colombo, a TV audience well into the hundreds of millions will be following. The hope now is that the uncertain weather forecast doesn't ruin the next instalment of this special sporting rivalry.
Now a look at the morning papers. Many of the front pages carry yesterday's announcements by the UK and its European allies that Alexei Navalny was killed by Russia using a toxin from a rare frog found in Ecuador. The Mail on Sunday says scientists from the UK's secretive Porton Down military base analysed samples from Mr. Navalny's body that were smuggled out of Russia after his death in an Arctic penal colony. The Observer notes that the frogs lose their toxicity when they're captive and identifies the poison's likely origin as a Russian state institute for chemistry that's currently under UK sanctions. The Defence Secretary John Healey is being lined up by Labour rebels to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the party leadership, according to the Sunday Telegraph. The paper says Mr. Healey is seen as the unity candidate, drawing support from all sides of the party. The moderate wing of MPs is said to believe that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has become too toxic after he published his WhatsApp messages with Lord Mandelson. And the Sunday Telegraph reports on research presented at a major scientific conference in Arizona that suggests death may not be instant, but rather a process lasting up to several hours. The research cites 20 studies on near-death experiences, including examples of people remaining alert to what's happening around them while they are biologically dead. The lead researcher says the findings pose questions for medicine and philosophy, as well as the ethics of organ donation. And that concludes our look at the papers.
And that was Tina Ritchie. This is BBC Radio 4. Tweet of the day and in other news are still to come before 9 o'clock. And the photographer, once called the king of the paparazzi, Richard Young, is Lauren Laverne's castaway on Desert Island Discs at 10 o'clock this morning. Now, though, time for Sunday Worship, which today explores St. Matthew's Gospel.
Good morning and welcome to St. Olive Hart Street. I'm the rector, Philip Dawson. The church was founded here in the city of London in 1050 and is dedicated to a Viking warrior who became king and then patron saint of Norway. The first healing miracle here associated with Olaf is recorded in the 12th century. Some say our curious pronunciation of Olaf as Olive comes from the Cockneys who worked the nearby docks. Others hear in it a closer echo of the Norwegian. A survivor of the Great Fire, the story of this church is entwined with London's mercantile and maritime past. Samuel Pepys, buried here, called it his own church. John Betjeman described it as a country church in the world of Seething Lane. Olaf and Olive, city and countryside, warrior and healer. Like all lives set down in text, the story of this place is layered rather than clear-cut. A place where apparent opposites are held in holy tension, where lives meet and meaning quietly emerges. We're delighted to be joined today by Laura Luth and Di Woolridge to explore St. Matthew's Gospel and to have our reflections enriched with music sung for us by the St. Martin's Voices.
God, Matthew's Gospel was written to a community living in a fragmented and dissonant world. Those who had embraced Jesus as the Savior were left wondering, if that man truly had been the Messiah, surely he wouldn't have left the world like this. To those feeling the weight of the world on their shoulders, this gospel offers an invitation to rethink our views of who God is in the chaos of our world. To repent, literally turn away from false ideas of power and religion, and ask ourselves the question Jesus asks: who did you come to see? Lord, as we approach these scriptures, may our prayer be that we are not so blinded by our idea of religion and power that we miss where you are, truly amongst us. Amen.
Our first reading is from Matthew chapter 5, beginning at verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me.
You know who's blessed? Those who are spiritually skint, out of pocket but know it. They're in the red, maxed out on all their moral credit cards, but don't act as if their statement reads loaded. They know that when it comes to being perfect, their credit rating is way off. But guess what? They search debt advice and look for help. You know who's blessed? Those who grieve. Those who mourn. Those who take a selfie with their own fragility, mortality, and vulnerability and plead that the person in the picture makes better life choices. I'm telling you, these are the ones who are going to know comfort beyond words. You know who's blessed? Those who don't get sucked into the dog-eat-dog world, who don't throw their weight around or step on others to get ahead. They're not soft, not a pushover, they're gentle. These are the ones who'll inherit all that cannot be bought. You know who's blessed? Those who don't take injustice lying down, whose lives are all out committed to the campaign of truth, honour and love. Those who rep the downtrodden and oppressed, who fight their corner, but they're not forcing their agenda. It's not about them or their interpretation of what's right. Since when are we perfect? Instead, they submit themselves to the perfect code and let that guide their actions. These are the ones who will be filled to complete satisfaction. You know who's blessed? Those who cut others some slack, who don't get their kicks out of the consequences of others, but given the opportunity, deal out a hand of second chances. I'm telling you, these are the ones who'll be greeted with second chances when they deserve what's coming to them. You know who's blessed? Those who get vain about how they look on the inside, who spend hours in the mirror to get their heart just right. These are the ones who'll see what their vision cannot display, i.e. him. You know who's blessed? Those who diffuse confrontation, Those who don't go looking for trouble, but when they do find it, they don't end up locking fists with faces. They find a way to resolve conflict. These are the ones who'll get Child of God permanently stamped on their passport. You know who's blessed? Those who get slammed for holding on to what's honourable and true. These are the ones who receive the perfect rule of heaven and all that brings with it. So what about you? Are you blessed?
Are we blessed? Rather than taking the challenges of life away, Jesus invites those around him to see how the stress and pain sits alongside blessing. We are asked, do you want an inner, present peace that acknowledges the reality of your life independent of what's in your newsfeed, inbox, or bank balance? Can you trust that your spiritual well-being isn't found in following religious rules, but in inviting Jesus into the entirety of your life, in all its messiness and pain? Merciful God, help us to trust that you bless us in our lives, however you find us today. Amen.
Our next reading from Matthew chapter 18 encourages us to look to heaven, beginning at verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me.
Who's the greatest in God's book? Take a leaf out of the toddler's multi-sensory scratchbook. It's not the perfect, but the purer in heart. Not holding the world at arm's length, but with open arms to embrace. Not too proud to ask curious questions or too afraid to ask for help. Who's the greatest in God's book? Take a leaf out of the tween's fantasy adventure book. It's the juniors and teenagers, the ones not afraid of being world changers. Where unlike their grown-up counterparts, cynicism is still a bitter pill to swallow. Where play is serious business, where imagination dreams and what-if thinking is the syllabus of the day. Who's the greatest in God's book? Take a leaf out of the preschooler's picture book. It's the little looked-down-ons and looked-overs, underestimated children. For you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but a young pup is eager to learn, to grow, and not afraid to heal to the one who gives life-giving instruction. With open hands to hand out love without condition, to hold on, not afraid to be guided across the road crossings of life. With open hearts to know the surgeon who performs open heart surgery is trustworthy. So take a leaf out of God's book and be like children.
The Buddhists call it coming with a beginner's mind. But how hard we can find it to approach Jesus with openness, eagerness, and curiosity. Not coming as the expert, but coming as someone who doesn't know. A child with questions. Imagine yourself sat like these children, wondering who Jesus is. What questions do you ask him? How does he welcome them? What does he reply? Welcoming God, help us speak the questions of our hearts. Amen.
Thank you.
We hear the first commandment now, from Matthew chapter 22, beginning at verse 34. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments.
Love God with all your heart. Not just with the feels or when you love when it's hard. Yes, a love like that sounds scary, for a love like that leaves you open. But he is trustworthy to treat your beating heart tenderly, and he'll never return it broken. See that where he wears his heart is on his blood-soaked sleeves. For love, he rolled up his sleeves with outstretched arms at Calvary. Love God with all your mind. Know his nature with your noggin. Put his magnificence under the microscope. His love holds up under logic. So calculate with curiosity the sheer velocity of his kindness. Study him like astrophysicists study space, for there's no sun big enough to eclipse the gravity of the sun's love. Love God from the boots of your soul. Love him from the depths of you, the parts of you you've cordoned off with barricade tape. Love him with all your facts, all your facets, all your features, all of you. Why? Because that is just the tip of the iceberg, or a drop in the ocean of how much he loves to love you. For he loved first. He loved to the point he changed postcode from heaven to earth. For his heart beats love, and his love beat death.
It's a big change. Moving from seeing God as one who gives many laws to follow, laws we can memorize, laws we can obey, to noticing a God who comes to us disguised as our lives. This is the simple invitation of Jesus. Compassionate God, help us to find you in the love we give and receive, to let go of everything else. Amen.
Thank you.
Our final reading this morning is from Matthew 25, beginning at verse 31. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go and visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me."
When he shows up, when he finally comes back in all his fullness, the Son of Man will take a seat on his glorious throne. All nations will be arranged right in front of him, and then he'll sort out who's who, like a shepherd sorts the sheep from the goats. Then the King of Glory will say to the sheep, "The door's wide open. Make yourself a home, you who were in my Father's good books." Let me tell you why. Because when I was hungry, you took me to a food bank and filled up my fridge and cupboards. I was homeless. You invited me in, called me guest, and gave up your bed while you slept on the sofa. When all I owned were the clothes on my back, not fit for cleaning rags, you kitted me out with a new wardrobe. You even got me a hat, gloves, and scarf so I could see out the winter months. When I was bedridden, at hospital or home, you came round with takeout and chocolate. When I was bored, you played cards with me. When I was locked up, serving time, even when you got flack for it, you showed up in visiting hours. Confused, the sheep will ask him, "Lord, when? When did we do all these things?" Then the king will kindly put them straight. "Don't you get it? Hand on heart, when you did this for the least, the look down on the forgotten, that was me. You did it for me too."
Sometimes we realize that all we have spent building up our life on is worthless, that we will be known by nothing, remembered for nothing but our ability to love. How do we respond when the castles, the political systems we've built in our lifetime crumble? Is it the end of our lives, Jesus asks? Creator God, help us today to take up your invitation to a new life in you. Amen.
Come.
Jesus, you invite us to abandon expert approaches to religion for the desert wilderness of our inner lives. Keep us childlike. Bless our small steps. As we tear down the empires we have built in our own image, open our hearts to our own fragility, to the poor, sick, and hurting. And in the mystery of that love, help us see you. Amen.
Sunday worship came from St. Olive Hart Street in the City of London. It was led by the Reverend Philip Dawson, with spoken word by Di Wooldridge and reflections by the Reverend Laura Luth. The choir, St. Martin's Voices, was directed by Andrew Eris. The producer was Alexa Good. Next week, on the first Sunday of Lent, Sunday worship comes from the Catholic Metropolitan Cathedral in Liverpool. The Long-Tailed Tit stars in Tweet of the Day in a moment after a look ahead to tomorrow morning here on Radio 4.
Could the chemicals in everyday products be causing us some serious harm?
One portion of fish was giving somebody a higher dose of PFAS than if they had drank contaminated water for a month.
I'm Mark Miodovnik. I'll be exploring the chemicals that are accumulating in almost everyone's bodies. From microplastics in bottled water to PFAS, the forever chemicals in our cosmetics.
We are going to continue to be exposed to them for centuries because they don't break down.
What are these chemicals doing to us? I'll be testing my kitchen, my bathroom, my producer's cat, and even my own blood to find out. Toxic begins tomorrow morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now, Tweet of the Day. The wildlife filmmaker Hannah Stitfall is looking for the long-tailed tit.
With short cold days and frost-laden trees now upon us, one of our most delightful little birds is busier than ever, the long-tailed tit. Like a tiny fluffy cotton ball, they move in chattering flocks through hedgerows and woodland edges. I remember seeing them as a child, dancing along the blackthorn, and they've been one of my favourite birds ever since. When night falls, these birds do something remarkable. They roost communally, huddling close on branches to survive the chill. A group can look like one giant ball of fluff. But in spring, the magic begins. This is one of my favourite wildlife highlights of the year, when I head out with my camera on a mission to film their nests. These are intricate domed structures built out of moss, feathers and spider silk, which expand to accommodate growing chicks. Both parents share incubation duties, but there's a twist. If a pair loses their brood, they often help relatives raise theirs. This sort of cooperative breeding is not often seen in small birds, and it's thought it's driven by kin selection. By helping relatives, their gene pool is more likely to survive. For me, the long-tailed tit is a perfect example of the quiet wonders in the British countryside. A reminder that even the smallest creatures live big, fascinating lives.
That was Hannah Stitfall. Tweet of the Day was produced by Sophie Anton. Now, here's Caroline Nichols with the series that looks at positive news stories away from the week's main headlines.
Welcome to In Other News, where the BBC's newsroom team takes a look at what's going right in the world. We often talk about economic growth in our news bulletins, typically the lack of it, and what can be done to stimulate more. So let's start by hearing from the city that's outperforming the rest of the UK. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
The very reasonable question about Britain's economy is really about long-term lack of growth. It's sort of pootling along. Now, Manchester, which happens to be my hometown, is an exception to that. It's been growing the most rapidly of all the major city regions, over 3%. And so people are asking the question, is there some sort of model? Is there something to copy?
Hi, I'm Sean Norton. I'm the CEO of On The Beach. We're an online travel agent.
I'm Emma Thackeray. I'm co-founder of Hip Hop, a soft drinks brand.
Lawrence Newman. I'm the founder and CEO of the Beauty Tech Group.
That's a BBC Radio roundtable of growing Manchester-based businesses. The economic buzz here was rather clear.
We've got a huge amount of talent pool from Greater Manchester. We have suppliers from around the world and Europe, and the access into Manchester Airport is very, very good. So I think you get all of the core ingredients that you want.
Manchester has an amazing food scene, an amazing hospitality scene, an amazing cultural scene.
There's five universities in Manchester, and the stickiness of people wanting to live here post-university, I think it's value for money compared to living in London. And there's some incredible businesses.
At Source, the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham told me this growth is about a significant change in attitude.
But imagine us walking down here in the 80s when you and I were growing up, and then turning this corner where we are now, and yeah, then seeing that.
If you go back about 7-8 years, we have more cranes on the skyline of Manchester than anywhere else, certainly in Europe.
What's the underlying dynamic here that is growth? It's the young people being seen as an asset to come in and fill those skyscrapers and therefore fill the accommodation.
It's a young city, it's always been like that. But the thing is now they can live here with a really good job and 21st century living accommodation
and bring up
young people.
And people are flowing into Manchester from the south?
Yes. There is an influx the other way round. I was part of the influx out in the 80s, and probably you were as well, when people had to leave here to get on in life. Now we have an inflow of young Londoners into Greater Manchester, which London. In the last couple of years, over 10,000, you know, that's not
from
something.
London.
Yes.
That is an astonishing turnaround. Well, what's your message to those guys?
We're really glad to have you. You're very welcome.
All of this has been part of a long-term plan going back to the 1990s, but helped by powers given to Manchester a decade ago by then-Chancellor George Osborne.
And getting Manchester through the Whitehall machinery, overcoming the political divide, was difficult enough, but I always thought this: if I could work with you to achieve this new model of civic leadership and local power here in Greater Manchester, I could hold it up to the rest of the country as an example of what was possible.
So it isn't just in the big numbers, you can see it with the cranes in the sky, the skyscrapers, just in terms of the number of people in the city centre, which when I was young, simply didn't have. You can see the growth, but how applicable is it to the rest of the country? Not every city has two Premier League clubs that are world famous, or Europe's biggest university campus. So not all of it is applicable, but something is happening in my hometown, and it is worthy of much more inquiry than is typical. And it could just be that there are lessons for the rest of the country.
Faisal Islam in Manchester. Not all business is just about making money. Clarity was the UK's oldest social enterprise, with a mission to help workers with disabilities. But when it collapsed 5 years ago, more than 100 people lost their jobs. Now, a new company has resumed Clarity's social mission, one bar of soap at a time. Ben King has more.
Clarity was founded in 1854 to provide opportunities for workers who were overlooked for their disabilities. Its patrons included Queen Victoria and Joanna Lumley. By 2020, it focused on making soap products, but it collapsed with a big shortfall in its pension fund. A man called Nicholas Marks bought the company out of administration. At first, he promised to keep it going, but it didn't turn out that way. Here's Camilla Marcus-Dew, who was the company's head of commercial.
He wasn't interested in growing jobs for disabled people and even protecting the jobs for the disabled people that we had working with us, which was truly heartbreaking to watch unfold.
The workers, many of them blind or visually impaired, were laid off and didn't get the wages, furlough or redundancy payments they were owed. The factory closed and the company was shut down, owing more than £400,000 to 84 employees. I reported on this in 2021, and after my article was published, Mr. Marks took Camilla and another person to court, wrongly blaming them for the company's problems. After a long and exhausting legal battle, that case was thrown out in the High Court. The pensions regulator charged Mr. Marks with fraudulently taking workers' pensions. He died before the case came to court. That could have been the end of the story. But Camilla has taken what she learned and started again.
I want to prove again that that's possible for people to step into work where they're really appreciated, feeling part of society. And it was a massive loss for the disability sector when Clarity went under. But we're doing it in our own way now at Amplify Goods.
I'm in East London at a vast warehouse operated by the homelessness charity Crisis. I can see clothes on racks, secondhand furniture, books and bedding. And over in the corner, there's a small group of people at work packing up soap. I'm going to go and say hello.
I like to get out of the house and to get money. I learned how to pack the box properly so that it could be on my CV.
I am working for different types of things, for packing for soap and labelling and stamping. Yeah, I really enjoy it.
I like coming here, talking to friends, doing learning new skills.
It's early days yet. But Camilla hopes the business can make a big impact.
I think often in these systems, people go, I don't have influence to create jobs for homeless and disabled people. I promise you do. I promise you do through the change of something like soap in a washroom.
You're listening to In Other News. A final report comes from Pakistan, where people have been celebrating the kite-flying festival, Basant, for the first time in 20 years. It was banned after deaths and injuries caused by sharp kite strings, aerial firing and rooftop falls. But after introducing restrictions, the city of Lahore has brought kite flying back. Let's go with our correspondent Caroline Davis, fly a kite.
Up, up, up! Sorry, sorry!
Turns out kite flying isn't that easy.
Sorry!
At least I'm not the only one learning. It's been about two decades since the Basant Festival was last allowed in Lahore. At the time, Abu Bakr Ahmed was only 6 years old.
Our old generations here are very excited about it. We Gen Zs don't know how to fly a kite.
Across Lahore, the skies are filled with a flicker of multicoloured kites. Everyone is searching for a good roof. Ideally, with some good music. Kasif Siddiqui, a born and bred Lahori, is feeling nostalgic.
It's about a tradition and my father and his father before him used to do.
The festival is centuries old, much loved, but the risks that come with the kites are real. The aim to try to cut your opponent's string before they cut yours. It's led to sharper, stronger strings, some coated in powdered glass, others made of metal or special chemicals.
This is the chemical string.
It does not break easily.
Faisal Kamran is the Deputy Inspector General of Lahore Police.
So why is that a danger?
Because if it comes in contact with human skin, it will not break away.
Those strings are now banned. Some streets have been covered in netting. Kites beyond a certain size have been banned too. They've also increased the surveillance, turning the cameras normally trained on the road to Lahore's rooftops.
So it's just gone midnight. Not that you would know that from walking through the walled city in Lahore. There are people still out